10 o'clock, and while we thought this would happen, we didn't think it would happen quite this quickly. The Financial Times reports today on Iranians in Iran who are rethinking their support for Donald Trump's intervention and indeed rethinking the price of possible but now incredibly unlikely regime change. While in the UK, Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe is one of three former political prisoners in Iran to join more than 100 Iranians living here who are now urging Keir Starmer not to get drawn further into the Iran conflict. It is, of course, the last platform of plausibility that the warmongers were clinging to, but it looks as though many Iranians are now changing their minds.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, at least three cargo ships have been hit as the Strait of Hormuz has again become a flashpoint in the conflict in the Middle East. It's unclear who fired the projectiles, but Iran has threatened to fire on any vessel in the strait. The shipping lane is a vital artery for oil supplies and is effectively being closed since the start of the conflict. Middle East correspondent for The Economist, Greg Karlstrom, is following developments for LBC.
The Americans saying overnight that they believe the Iranians have started to lay down some mines, some naval mines in the strait. Not a large number, but an attempt to physically block traffic through the strait. Huge concerns in energy markets.
Ministers are warning their ability to shield taxpayers from higher energy bills could depend on how long the war continues. The Chancellor has said that she is expecting the rate of inflation to increase as oil and gas exports from the Gulf drop. In the last few minutes, Rachel Reeves has been speaking to the Treasury Committee. She said it's not good for the British economy to have trade disrupted.
At this stage, I think it would be unwise to speculate on what the impact on inflation, growth or interest rates would be. But, of course, we are looking at a number of scenarios and monitoring very carefully the situation. But the quicker we can de-escalate, the better it will be for all of those different economic variables.
The government has approved a police request to ban a protest march in London this weekend. There were concerns about the annual Al-Quds Day march over its apparent backing for Iran's late supreme leader. Organisers insist it's always been peaceful. The first documents relating to Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to Washington will be released by Downing Street later. There have been questions over how the peer was vetted and what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. Lord Mandelson has always denied any wrongdoing. And Heathrow says it's recorded its busiest February on record last month. 5.8 million passengers passed through the airport. It says it benefited from a bumper half term combined with Chinese New Year travel. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 99 at 10,312. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy with outbreaks of rain for most. Some brighter spells will develop by the afternoon, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hey Sainsbury's, we get through so many snacks. Have you got anything to help me save?
Well, we're always matching and lowering prices. So hundreds of Sainsbury's fresh fruit, veg and everyday products are price matched to Aldi. And every week with Nectar, you can save money on thousands of the products your family loves. So you can snack away knowing you're saving money. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us. Selected products, Aldi price match not in NI. Nectar prices require Nectar account. Terms at sainsburys.co.uk/Aldi price match and nectar.com/prices terms.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. Would it be childish and inappropriate, or would it be a welcome slice of levity in an otherwise unbearably serious sea of news to use today's programme, at least in part, to anoint King or Queen Ferret? I mean the public figure. I suppose this is following on from Nick's theme about beavers and otters. I'd like to introduce ferrets to the equation, specifically that lesser-spotted reverse ferret, or in the case of our right-wing media this week, the greater-spotted reverse ferret. But we would anoint king or queen ferret, as in the public figure who is either most assiduously ignoring the opinion they held about Donald Trump's war in Iran last week, or abandoning it and ploughing ahead regardless in entirely the opposite direction. I've got four contenders for you at the moment for the title of King or Queen Ferret. Kemi Badenoch is very much in the field. Nigel Farage, inevitably, has found himself blowing in the wind like an entirely unreliable and unprincipled charlatan. Perish the thought. Andrew Neil in the Daily Mail, as we suggested may occur, has undergone an extraordinary sea change. And Richard, call me Dick Littlejohn, in the Daily Mail, is so ashamed to be British that he stopped writing about the war entirely and started writing instead about lollipop ladies. So I don't know. Who is the king or the queen of the ferrets, the reverse ferrets? We may play that game a little later in the programme. Would you like to play another game as well? This is a bit niche, all right? If you've got no idea what you're listening to, you've accidentally tuned in your radio, or you have no clue who I am, which is a perfectly reasonable and probably an enviable position in which to find yourself, then just forgive me and indulge me for a moment. I got very excited yesterday about the fact that Eleanor laminated my Chilcot checklist. It normally takes me months to have my requests met, if indeed they are ever met at all on this programme, such as the torpor of the production process on this programme. All the others get whatever they want within 10 minutes. But I got my Chilcot checklist laminated within less than 24 hours. And I mean... I have it with me now, so I don't want you to worry. Laminated. I've got some other laminated things as well that Eleanor did for me for reasons I'm not entirely clear about, but I'll tell you what else she laminated. Is there an episode of a sitcom where they just laminate everything? I remember Phoebe's brother in Friends just liked melting things. Do you remember Phoebe's brother in Friends just liked melting things? They said to him, what do you do? Do you have any hobbies? And he said, yeah, I like melting things. Eleanor, it seems, just likes laminating things. So I'll tell you some of the other things she's laminated later in the programme. But I got very excited yesterday about my laminates. How long do you think it took me to lose it? Had I lost my laminate, which I have now recovered, I want to make that clear. Do you think that I lost it after 6 hours, 5 hours, or 4 hours? How long do you think it took me to lose my laminate? Yes, that is a game you are welcome to play. So we've got ferrets, we've got laminates, and now we have the business proper. And the business proper begins in really uncomfortable territory this morning. I don't know if you can tell when I am not super comfortable on the radio. It's my privilege, I suppose, to form my own opinions on the whetstone of your knowledge. Quite a lot of the views that I hold most dear are born of conversations that I've had with you over the years, sometimes quite heated conversations. There is nothing like an argument to either convince you or dissuade you from a position that you previously held. But sometimes I've got an opinion and I am very authentic in holding it, but I am a little bit uncomfortable defending it against people who have more skin in the game. Does that make sense? So there were a couple of occasions last week when people of Iranian heritage were telling me how pleased they were about the attacks upon their home country. And I felt very uncomfortable arguing that they shouldn't be pleased. I didn't resile from the position. I didn't bottle it, but I certainly didn't go in anywhere near as hard as I would do in other circumstances of disagreement. And I think that's the right thing to do. You know, I sometimes finish phone calls thinking I've been too soft on someone, and I sometimes finish phone calls thinking I've been too hard on someone. But mostly I finish phone calls thinking I reckon we got that about right. But arguing with somebody with family in Iran, with history in Iran, with loved ones in Iran, friends, family, arguing with someone Iranian about an attack upon their own country and trying to tell them, if they welcomed it, that they shouldn't, That's about as close as I get to profound discomfort in the context of conversations, because I found myself increasingly drawn to the observation that you're trusting the wrong people, regardless of your hunger for regime change and regardless of the horrific nature of that regime. Trump isn't going to be your friend. Donald Trump isn't anybody's friend. Benjamin Netanyahu certainly isn't going to be your friend. These people, these men are not people you should be entrusting with your security and your faith. And of course, the argument that came back 9 months ago when we were covering that war that they both told us, Trump and Netanyahu, had been so extraordinarily successful that there would be peace in the region now for generations. That was just 9 months before they launched an even bigger war. I took a call from somebody who used a very spiky analogy. And the analogy was that if your children were being held hostage in a house and the only person coming to their rescue was a rapist, you would welcome the intervention of the rapist. And I had a thought at the time that I've articulated to you a couple of times this week, but very, what would the word be? Very cautiously. Because I it's a horrible extension of the analogy, but I think it works, and you will tell me if you think it doesn't. What happens when the rapist has killed the kidnapper? And that is why I don't like that analogy anymore. And I think that many Iranian people are beginning to realize that their initial entirely understandable and well-founded enthusiasm for the attack was misplaced. Whether entirely misplaced, as in the entire mission, the entire undertaking, is something that they should not have been in favor of, or whether simply the men leading it being entirely unworthy and undeserving of support, admiration, or frankly anything other than prison sentences, in my humble opinion. And that seems to be where we are today. So I've got, before we look a little later this hour at the battle, the very heated battle for the coveted title of King or Queen Ferret, let's look at people who are changing their minds and deserve nothing but sympathy and support in that process rather than mockery and derision. And it is into that camp that I think these Iranians fit. So there are two stories in the news today that speak directly to what I'm saying to you. One is in the Financial Times, which really is a newspaper like no other, whatever the issue, obviously economics being their meat and drink, but it's a newspaper that just pursues standards of journalism, the likes of which hardly anybody else now comes close to in this country. And they write under the headline today, Iranians rethink the price of regime change. And the journalist, Najmeh Borzoghmeh, speaks to a number of Iranians, many using pseudonyms, because of course the regime will come after people who dare to criticize it, who have changed their mind. Here's a very good one. When the two countries, this is the USA and Israel, of course, attacked the compound of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on February the 28th, killing him and several of his family members, Mandana, who, like others interviewed, used a pseudonym, believed the change she coveted had finally come. Her experience in the terrifying days since has shattered that belief. The journalist goes on, approaching 2 weeks into the war, no signs exist of the sort of anti-regime unrest that broke out across the country in January before being crushed in a brutal crackdown that killed thousands. Instead, many, even those who loathe the Islamic Republic, appear to have recoiled at the destruction and comments, including Donald Trump's threat to target electricity production facilities if the regime escalated. And there are other examples and other explanations. If things stay like this, said Mahboube, a translator, we're in a worse place now than before the war. A country destroyed, Khamenei replaced by another Khamenei 30 years younger. And then we come to Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, an incredible woman I've had the great privilege of meeting on a number of occasions and who remains an absolute beacon for liberty and freedom, having spent years in an Iranian jail. She has added her name to a letter signed by more than 100 Iranians, urging Keir Starmer not to get drawn further into the conflict. Indeed, they argue that the way in which the war is being conducted is strengthening the regime in Tehran. It's a counterpoint, of course, to people still in the diaspora who still call for the return of Reza Pahlavi, the exiled son of the former Shah, to lead a sort of transition into democracy. Pahlavi, of course, was installed into power by MI6 and the CIA when the democratically elected leader of Iran looked like he was going to nationalize oil production, which would have been terribly bad news for very rich Westerners. So much of history can be distilled down to that one single simple observation. This is what the letter says. Nobody can claim to want the end of the Islamic Republic more than we do. But attacking the country in this way will have the opposite effect. It will entrench the authoritarians and give life to the fiction that has sustained them internally for decades, that they are fighting Western imperialism. 15 minutes after 10 is the time. So there it is. There it is. I don't think today is a day for I told you so or anything like that, but the notion that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu would do anything to benefit the ordinary Iranian citizen struck me 2 weeks ago as fanciful and absurd and highly unlikely, and it strikes me today as impossible. You're talking about two men so entirely driven by self-interest and self-preservation that the notion of them doing something that was altruistic or born of principle or designed to deliver outcomes that were morally coded is, to me, the daftest thing I can remember hearing anybody argue in the longest time. I pointed out to you some time ago that the reason, well, one of the upshots of Trump and his regime being entirely unable to describe why they were waging war or what the goal of war was to enable them to claim victory, regardless of what happened. Again, I expected that to happen. I didn't expect it to happen quite this quickly. Trump simultaneously claiming that he's won and he has not yet done enough winning. While nobody really continues to believe that they've got the first idea of what victory would actually entail. Regime change, but not regime change. Removal of ballistic missiles, but not the removal of ballistic missiles. And if we somehow remove the ballistic missiles from the air, which is technically impossible, we don't have a plan on what we'll do when they start making ballistic missiles again, almost immediately. A punishment of the Iranian regime for the crackdown and the abuses of the Iranian protesters back in January, except there's nothing of the sort. They're now attacking Iran for not having risen up against a government that possesses all the weapons, all the power, and all the bullets. So it wasn't about regime change, it wasn't about weapons removal, it wasn't about human rights abuses, it was none. And of course, there are plenty of people in the West, including our four contenders for King or Queen Ferret of the Year, Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage, Andrew Neil, and Richard Littlejohn. All of these idiots cheering it on, calling for more, insisting on war, wanging on about being ashamed to be British because Keir Starmer didn't join in with this hideous campaign, and within the space of a fortnight, it's all fallen apart. I have no sympathy for British public figures who didn't have the wit to understand the simplest of premises or the basest motivations of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. But I have nothing but sympathy for Iranians who were so desperate for change that they would embrace any agent of change at all. And of course, they embraced these men, Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. So, where are we today? I haven't actually done a phone-in that was prioritizing Iranian people. I thought I would, but I didn't, partly because, of course, it was different from previous engagements in that our big question as British people was whether or not the British government should get more involved in Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's adventure in Iran. That is understandably the element of the conversation that
interests us most? Should we be getting involved? To which I think the answer was and always will be absolutely flipping not. And the people who didn't understand that a fortnight ago seem to be coming around to a position of understanding now. So where do you stand now? As an Iranian, as somebody who has family in Iran, has history in Iran, as part of the Iranian diaspora, when you hear former political prisoners of the regime, who quite rightly remind us that nobody can claim to want the end of the Islamic Republic more than they do, urging Keir Starmer not to get more involved, and when you read of people in Iran who were initially optimistic, upbeat and enthusiastic about the attacks, despairing of what has happened and what is likely to happen next, where does it leave you? And you don't have to be Iranian. I'd like to give priority to Iranians today, 03456060973. But, of course, people who thought this would be a good idea and now realise that it wasn't can hail from any corner of the country or any part of the planet, frankly. So there it is. And I mean it. I met a lovely bloke last night who gave me £10 to put in Keith's tin. Would you believe? This is back to Brexit. And Errol, who I met at a very jolly event, I may tell you a little bit more about later, was so apologetic for supporting Brexit. I used to get this quite a lot. I haven't had it for a while. And we used to say to Keith, get the tin, and I'd have to put a quid in it every time I used the phrase, I told you so. It would be entirely inappropriate, except in the context of the British commentators and politicians who have once again humiliated themselves with their arrogant certainty despite their epic ignorance. Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage, Andrew Neil, Dick Littlejohn. For the Iranian people, anybody who even comes close to suggesting I told you so is ghoulish and mean. So we won't be doing that, not by any stretch of the imagination, but we will be wondering where we are today, having greeted the intervention with understandable enthusiasm, albeit that it would almost certainly involve the deaths of Iranian civilians. That was a price considered worth paying for the ultimate goal of liberty or regime change or whatever you thought the ultimate goal may be. Where are we now? 03456060973 is the number that you need. As an Iranian or as a supporter of the original intervention, how are you processing the way that it has gone? It's 10:21. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The number you need is 03456060973.
LBC.
It's the last chance to get yourself a ticket for tonight's Lotto draw.
It could be you.
Lotto. From the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
You're really building that business, Josh. That's because you chose to bank with Virgin Money, earning cash back on your supplies, turning expenses into rewards on everything from Sanders to skip hire. He came, he soared, he conquered. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus. Terms and exclusions apply. Cashback rate of 0.25% backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
My name's Mark and this is my NHS story. The sensation in my neck was painful all the time. Once I spoke to my GP, they referred me to my CDC. They got me in very, very quickly. The amount of pain I went through for something so easy, why hadn't I done this 4 months before?
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
23 minutes after 10 is the time. It's a bit of a recurring theme in my inbox, and I will address it early, although I follow my own honour code on these things, my own principles. It doesn't matter what other presenters on LBC do. I'm not comfortable with my colleagues being criticised in circumstances that they can't immediately respond to. If you want to criticise me, you can ring me. if you want to criticise my colleagues, you can ring them. But if we'll start criticising each other or allowing callers to criticise each other, and I appreciate some of my colleagues do allow callers to criticise other presenters, I'd like to think I'm better than that. I hope that doesn't sound too smug. So I'm not going to tell you who this is about, but I am going to read it to you in anonymous terms. In fact, there's two. First of all, Sarah says, why don't you interview some of your colleagues about why they supported the war? I'd be happy to if they wanted to have that conversation. And another one says, a cunning piece of ferretry has been conducted by bleep, 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 bleep. He has deftly moved from, she has deftly moved from criticising Sir Keir Starmer for not following Trump into war to criticising Keir Starmer for not sufficiently explaining why he didn't follow Donald Trump into war. I appreciate you can't read this out as they are a colleague, but it's a very good example nonetheless. And finally, this from James on a slightly different note. It's not a moment for I told you so, James, but only because we have sympathy and empathy. But we should mark this as a bad idea and blame those who backed it, not unlike Brexit. And no, I won't just stop talking about it. And if we were to focus upon esteemed and beloved colleagues, I wonder how many of the people rattling their sabres and calling for war and attacking Keir Starmer for not joining in also told you, and perhaps even in some cases continue to tell you, that Brexit would be brilliant and an excellent idea. I don't know why those two things go hand in hand, but my goodness me, I'd probably find it hard to come on air in the future if I'd been that wrong about such enormous things as Brexit, a war, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, austerity. I mean, crikey. Anyway, it's a good job we're all different. Adam's in Haringey. Adam, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James.
Hello, Adam.
Pleasure to speak to you.
Well, we'll see. It's early days, mate. Let's not get carried away. God.
Yeah, just really wanted to say, first off, just to introduce myself.
Yes.
I'm actually a member of the Sunni community in Iran. We're a very, very small minority.
Gosh, yes.
And my family had to flee to the UK, seek asylum, because we have been sort of disenfranchised, and a lot of my family members have actually had a lot of atrocities at the hands of this current regime.
Never been a fan
of these people. Of never will be. Okay, I just wanted to set the record straight.
Yeah, good.
However, what's going on now, and honestly, the state of the Iranians in the West, the diaspora. I'm not speaking on behalf of all of them, but
of
a lot of them that I've been seeing and I've been hearing on LBC cheering on these bombs that have been dropping on our people. Dancing in the streets. This is absolutely shocking. Like, I just can't fathom what is going through these people's minds.
Well,
James.
You've got
the United States, right?
Yeah.
Who have entered every country willy-nilly and gone about their business, acted like peacemakers, and then set up their oil companies and obviously profited from so much of war. What war generally gives people.
Yes.
Then you've got the other hand, Israel, who have, let's be honest, have committed a genocide against these Palestinian people, and these Palestinian people have been defenceless for the last two or so years. We've been seeing it on our TV screens. We've been seeing it on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter. We've been seeing the devastation that these lot have caused, and then you know they'll parade around as they're the peacemakers. And these Iranians genuinely think that these two groups are going to give us peace and prosperity? Come on, man, seriously, wake up.
Are you not wake describing desperate? I mean, it's your family, your history, your country of origin, so I'm a little bit uncomfortable pushing back against you from the privilege of having grown up in Kidderminster and sitting in a cosy London radio studio. But you're describing desperation. You're being a little unkind when you talk about dancing in the streets and cheering. It was
It's
born of a desperate desire to see the regime toppled.
Want to see the regime toppled more than anyone, but I don't want to see my beautiful nation full of beautiful people I've seen images of videos of babies being dragged out the rubble. I don't want to see that. I genuinely don't want to see that. I don't want to see my population go from 90 million to God knows what and then have a refugee crisis just like the rest of our neighbours have had.
But what then, do you want?
For America to say, oh, we made a mistake. You know, you've got Donald Trump saying that Iranians cut women in half and chop babies' heads off. And then you've got Pete Hegseth just shaking his head like, yeah. This is nonsense.
Well, they're turning it into an episode of Call of Duty now, I think, in the Department of War.
Come on, Iranian people are some of the most intelligent people you'll ever meet.
I feel the frustration in your voice. It's powerful and important. I'm just interested in whether you felt this way from the very start, because you're not in a position where you've gone from, and here's a good word, cautious. Mm-hmm. So a cautious welcome is not what you saw when you saw people dancing and celebrating. There was nothing cautious about that. It was, I would argue, born of desperation and therefore forgivable. You would argue that it's unforgivable.
100%, James. And I'll be very honest with you. I was very, very happy when I saw the news of Khamenei's death. Okay. I was very, very happy. Because I've been wanting that, and I'm not going to swear, I really want to do swear, but I've been wanting that guy...
Welcome to my world, yeah.
...to die for a long time.
And then they replaced him with his son, and they stuck in a
come on.
30 years younger version 2.0. What do you think? How do you think it ends?
I know, well, if it's going the way it's going, there is not going to be a Tehran left. There's not going to be a Tahrir's... you know, they're attacking UNESCO World Heritage Sites.
Yeah.
Golestan Palace, Google it. It's one of the most beautiful places. Full of so many ancient artifacts. And it's just turned into rubble now because Israel claimed that we've been planning to get nuclear weapons for the last 30 years and we're always going to be 2 weeks away from it. Again, this is coming from a Sunni Iranian that's always been and has had family been attacked by the people at the top. But at the end of the day, what I care about is the Iranian people. All right, and I do not want to see the same things that happen in Afghanistan, happen in Iraq, happen to my people. Okay, there is a way to get this regime out. Diplomacy is the answer. Education is the answer. Not dropping bombs. Bombs will not provide freedom. They never have, and they never will. And no one can tell me otherwise, James. I'm sorry.
I'm not going to try, Adam. I'm not even going to try because I agree with almost everything that you said. And of course I remain, and this is the luxury of not having family or skin in the game. I remain utterly, utterly confused and slightly inappropriately fascinated by the people in my line of work or the British politicians who were cheering it on from the very start and attacking Keir Starmer for seeing so clearly what you have just described so powerfully. And it's probably not fair to ask what happens next, because the people in charge of the war don't know what happens next. They don't know why they're doing it, really, apart from epic distraction from the Epstein files on the case of Donald Trump, or a desperate attempt to turn around his own political fortunes at home. And of course, in the case of Benjamin Netanyahu, it will be a large part of a process conceived originally simply to keep him out of courtrooms. It is 10:31. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A lot of admiration coming in for Adam. Dominic Ellis is here now with your headlines.
At least three cargo ships have been hit in the Strait of Hormuz this morning. It's unclear who fired the projectiles, but Iran has threatened to fire on any vessel in the key shipping route. The government has approved a police request to ban a protest march in London this weekend. There were concerns about the annual Al-Quds Day march over its apparent backing for Iran's late supreme leader. Organisers insist it's always been peaceful. And the first batch of files relating to Lord Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the US are due to be made public. The government's releasing them over concerns about how the peer was vetted and what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. He's always denied any wrongdoing. LBC weather, cloudy without breaks of rain for most. Some sunny spells developing later. A high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the LBC app.
With over 50 years experience, Fidelity can help you feel confidently invested. Make the most of your annual allowances by the 5th of April with our expert insights, excellent service and wealth of investment options. For ISAs, pensions or advice, go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
It's the last chance to get yourself a ticket for tonight's Lotto draw.
It could be you.
Lotto, from the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
Calling all young creatives. Kickstart your career in media. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12 at Global Academy. GlobalAcademy.com.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60
60 973. 10:34 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where the, I'm afraid I can only put it in these terms, the expected and predicted turnaround in thoughts and opinions among Iranians in Iran and members of the Iranian diaspora has arrived, but somewhat earlier than scheduled. I felt and said to you that with Netanyahu and Trump in charge, this was bound to end in disaster, because there is no way on earth that either of them are motivated by concern for the Iranian people. The arguments that we heard from people who have no skin in the game, like me, but who somehow, and for reasons I don't fully understand, love war, particularly when it involves killing Muslims, and there are plenty of them in the British political and media establishments, were adamant that it was being, that Donald Trump had suddenly discovered a deep concern for people suffering human rights abuses in Iran. This is Donald Trump, who felt zero concern for American citizens being shot dead by his own agents on the street of Minneapolis. But apparently he cares passionately about Iranians being killed or tortured by the Iranian regime. I mean, come on. on what possible planet does that make any form of sense? So I reserve contempt for the commentators and politicians in this country who went along with it, but I have nothing but sympathy for the Iranians, both inside and outside Iran, who welcomed it from a place of desperation. But you're moving already, I sense, I read, I learn. And the letter from Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe, Adam's description of his own family and his own background really resonates with this line in this letter. Nobody can claim to want the end of the Islamic Republic more than we do. But attacking the country in this way will have the opposite effect. I don't know if you came across this argument, but the idea that if you were pointing out that this was bound to end in disaster, then some people sought to portray you as being supportive of the Ayatollah. So you'd say, don't trust Donald Trump, don't trust Benjamin Netanyahu, this is going to end quite possibly in a situation that will be even worse in Tehran, even worse in Iran for Iranians than the situation that they're in today. And what have we got? We've got the Ayatollah replaced with his even more hardline 30-year younger son, to which some people would respond by saying, so why do you support the regime then? And you'd think, that's a level of stupidity so dense I don't think I can even chip away at it. It is so pathetic, so dangerously stupid, to respond to people who are correct by accusing them of supporting the Iranian regime because they don't want this war to be led by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Or they don't want this war that is led by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. How could you imagine doing that to Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe? So here's Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe saying, don't get involved, Keir Starmer. And here is your friendly neighbourhood blowhard saying, why do you support the regime then? What is it about the regime that you like so much, Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe? I'm not exaggerating. I've witnessed this mode of argument myself. Somebody explaining why these men and this war are disastrous, being accused of somehow supporting or admiring the Iranian regime. Well, just try that on Nazanin. Go on, I dare you. 10:38 is the time. Sarah is in Hampstead. Sarah, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello, Sarah.
I'm an Iranian Brit. I have family in Iran. I'm desperately worried for their safety in Tehran. You know, just to give you a personal story, my grandmother and my auntie and their little kids, they were in Tehran. They left Tehran to go to the outskirts. When they got there, they said the strikes and the noise was so bad they had to go back to Tehran, where they couldn't breathe because the air was toxic.
This is the black rain I've been reading about. It's unbreathable air. Black rain, they're calling it. Sorry. It's just horrible.
It's absolutely disgraceful. And I hold any Iranian in the diaspora who advocated for this war in absolute disdain. I was against this from the start. I kept saying, why do you think you're going to be different from Syria, Libya or Iraqis? And they just said, well, because we're a friend of Israel.
Right.
And you might be a friend of Israel. Doesn't mean that Israel is a friend to you. You're a useful tool of what Israel's plans are for the region. And you're advocating for this so that people like Donald Trump can post on their Twitter that we are doing this for the Iranians.
Yeah.
But may I set out some of the groundwork that's been set for this, that they've been working on the Iranians in the diaspora
past
2-3 years. We have, as you'll imagine, most diaspora communities, they have their own sort of international television channels, right?
Hmm.
Which is even more necessary in Iran because any Iranian station is regime controlled. So you rely on international stations and international people to set up their own television channels and to broadcast it to their own diaspora and to people in Iran. Two of these stations, the first one was Manotor, the second one was Iran International. For the past 2-3 years, they have been setting the scene for this. They started by advocating that the son of the Shah should come back. And every day they would just replay these images of how fantastic it was under the Shah, completely forgetting all the brutality that people like my mother and my father experienced under the Shah, people like my grandfather who was imprisoned under the Shah. Completely just whitewashing over that, telling everyone how fantastic it was under the Shah. We were friends with Israel, we were friends with America, and why can't Iran be like that again? That's how it started. And of course, as an Iranian, you're looking at this and thinking, well, look at how they portrayed my country now versus how they portrayed it under the Shah. Of course, I want to go back to that. And then they started by saying, and then obviously the protests in Iran happened. I'm not just talking about January protests, but back to the Women Life Freedom protests. Protests in Iran happened. And they latched onto this to say, okay, this is the time when we actually ramp up the rhetoric and we say we need foreign intervention in Iran. And this is,
So you're watching this unfold, presumably, with a very grim sense of foreboding.
What's happening now, I'm watching unfold. Absolutely. I was against this from the very start.
No, I meant the process. I meant this softening up process. This propaganda process must have been horrible to watch.
Yes. And I saw my own family members in Iran and they were watching this and they would parrot back what they've seen on Iran International, saying, well, but the Crown Prince, you know, like he seems like a nice guy. But if he's in the pockets of the Israelis, if he goes to Israel and has meetings with Netanyahu, who says he also wants a destruction of Iran, how on earth do you think he's going to come out and advocate on your behalf as a good faith actor? But that's how it's. So when you say the Iranians in the diaspora who are watching these things and are here and they're hearing that, you know, Israel wants to come and save you, America wants to come and save you, that's where it comes from. It's not just something, when you say it's out of desperation, yes, one part of it is desperation. The other part is that they have been brainwashed to believe that they've been soaking in these things from TV telling them that how great it's going to be once the Shah comes back.
There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And of course, Trump is treating the Shah's son with very similarly to how he treated the Venezuelan opposition leader, the Venezuelan leader in exile who won the Nobel Peace Prize. The people on the ground in Venezuela and in Iran may think that he is an agent of change, but he's nothing of the sort. He's keeping them both at arm's length while dedicating himself to trying to get somebody he fancies into the top position, and of course succeeding in Venezuela and so far failing in Iran. The thing that people listening will need your help with is the is the holding two thoughts in your head at the same time. It's why the letter from Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe and over 100 other British Iranians is so powerful. You can despise this regime. You can wish for its disappearance with every fibre of your being. And at the same time, you can be repulsed by the action being taken by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, and of course in their cases by the men taking the action. And do you understand why people on the outside can't quite fully grasp how you can hold those two positions at the same time? Because surely any attempt to topple this regime is to be welcomed because the regime is so awful.
No, not if it's at the expense. Not if it's at the expense of what I'm seeing in Iran, where schools are being hit, where a dialysis center has been hit, where the pharmaceutical companies that make medication, because Iran is under sanctions. So anything Iran does, it doesn't do with international help. You know, it can't just go and buy medicines on the international market because of the sanctions. They have to make themselves. So when they hit the pharmaceutical companies, the dialysis centers, the schools, the hospitals, no. I don't think we can just want regime change at absolutely any cost.
No, I was thinking more before, because I think the events you describe will have focused the mind and changed minds. That's why I really recommend this piece in the Financial Times today under the headline, Iranians Rethink the Price of Regime Change. I'm just expressing an understanding of where they were before it started, or where they were in the first hours of it, because you are so desperate for change, you will grasp at straws, and these are the straws that Trump and Netanyahu offered. And then as the reality began to settle and to become clear, you realised that these people, as you said at the outset, were not your friends at all, and were not motivated on any conceivable level by concern for or support for the Iranian population.
Exactly. I think you just have to look at the examples that everyone cites, you know, Iraq, Libya, Syria. Yeah. Why do you imagine that the Americans and the US are going to have any different intentions for you? When is America ever been concerned with actually helping civilian populations rather than just bombing them?
I don't know. It's a rhetorical question, I know, and it's not something we need to get into today, because I do know the answer to that question, because I asked Iranian people, not so much this time round, but 9 months ago. I was told that the Iranian character, the Iranian history, the Iranian even, and this is slightly thin ice for a whole bunch of reasons, even the Iranian or the Persian ethnicity was so different from the residents of the countries that you've just described, that things would go differently. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now.
Can I tell you where that stems from?
Please.
It's this idea, which is, you know, historically it's true, but in 2026 it holds no relevance, of Persia being the land of the Aryans. You know, that's what Iran means. It's the land of the Aryans.
Okay.
And Iranians, as we grow up, we like to hold ourselves differently and say that we are not Arabs. You know, we're not like the Saudis, we're not like the Iraqis, we're not like the Syrians, we're not Arabs, we are Aryans. And it doesn't have the connotations that it would have had in Germany, of course.
Right.
You know, it's not the same thing. But historically, you know, Iran was the land of the Aryan people. So they like to hold themselves out as, we are closer to America and we are closer to Israelis than we are to the Arab countries and the Arab neighbors next to us. And it's based on that we think we're going to be treated differently. And you'll have heard that when I see the Vox Pops. Yeah, on from the Iranian diaspora, and they say we're different to them. And as an Iranian that lives, I'm British Iranian, but as someone with Iranian origin that lives here, and I travel extensively in America, I'm not looked at as though I'm any different to anyone that is just brown. You know, they don't treat me differently because I'm Iranian. They just look at me as a brown person from the Middle East. And I think that's really lost on a lot of Iranians who live here. They like to hold themselves out differently. And it's a shame, because they are a bit cowards in terms of actually holding themselves out from that part of the region.
Gosh, I hope this doesn't sound patronizing, Sarah, but you had quite a lot to get off your chest this morning, I think.
Can I just put a prediction?
Yes.
I think I really have because any time you speak of this, they, as you just say, they tell you, oh, you must be pro regime. No, yeah. I despise the regime. They are evil people, and they're gross, and they need to be gone. But I think that over the next couple of weeks, you're going to see these marches from the Iranian diaspora die down. One reason in particular. One particular reason is that the Attorney General's office in Iran announced that any sort of dual Iranian citizen that lives abroad and has been found to be advocating for this war, they will lose any rights in Iran to, you know, if they have any land, if they have any income in Iran, if they have any inheritance in Iran, they will lose that right and they will be identified. And I reckon a lot of these people are now waking up to the fact that, oh, so you're saying I might not be able to, you know, keep getting my rent from the
and also,
Iran and live here.
Yes, but also more generously, that they are seeing that they were wrong. And you know, we all find it almost impossible to admit that we were wrong, but it will happen, and it is happening, and it's why the FT piece is so powerful today. And so it won't just be self-interest, it will be the evidence of their eyes and ears that becomes unignorable. Sarah, thank you. Thank you so much. Extraordinary calls today. I sometimes don't know what to say in response to the personal perspectives that are shared on the programme, and today is really, really one of those days. And we've barely started, technically. 10:49 is the time. Don't forget PMQ's on the way at 12, which reminds us of the battle to be crowned king or queen ferret when it comes to Western commentators who have no excuse whatsoever for being four square behind this. And listening to Sarah there reflect on that hideous positioning of people who would say to Sarah or to Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe or to anybody fully au fait with the situation on the ground in Iran and the character and history of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, that when they say this war is a bad idea, you respond by saying, oh, so you're a supporter of the regime, are you, in Tehran? I'll tell you what would be interesting. If you could find people who make that argument, but who also took money from the Iranian regime to appear on Press TV back in the day, I wonder if there's any crossover there at all, because I'd forgotten all about Press TV until Sarah started talking to us about how some of the propaganda from the other side of the Iranian divide has been disseminated throughout the diaspora. It's 10:50.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
President Trump seems to have declared sort of nearly the end of all of this, and I think, boringly, the question might have to be, well, what was all of this? The regime hasn't changed insofar as the same people are perpetuating the same ideas. Iran's military has definitely been degraded. I don't think there is any doubt in that. They have alienated potential Gulf allies, or at least nations that were around them, because they've hit them with various missiles. So, what changed?
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
At Kia, we know that inspiration begins with a first. Your first job. Your first love. Your first home. Now it's time for your first drive in the new Kia EV2 at our first drive weekends. It's your chance to be one of the first to test drive the Kia EV2 with its innovative technology and elegant eye-catching design. It's small in size, but big in personality. Discover what driving electric really means. Search First Drive Weekends to reserve your place today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato, and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify, pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
It's the last chance to get yourself a ticket for tonight's Lotto draw.
It could be you.
Lotto, from the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10:53 is the time. The other thing, I genuinely, since the beginning of last week, I have been watching goggle-eyed as people behaved in ways that I still can't understand. People in this building, let alone in the broader political and media landscape, are all gung-ho, all rattling their sabres, all calling for more war, all deriding and condemning international law, all looking at three men. Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Volodymyr Zelensky, and turning their brains off. Because, of course, the way that Trump treated Zelensky tells you exactly how much he cares about the victims of oppression or the victims of human rights abuses. And yet, I genuinely, I don't think if I live to be 112, I don't think I will ever understand how some people, some of them are just idiots, but some people just fell under a spell of support for a war being conducted by irredeemably awful people. One responsible for genocide in Gaza, one responsible for presiding over a regime that's killing its own citizens on the streets of Minneapolis, and invited Volodymyr Zelensky to the Oval Office for an international live-on-television humiliation. But you go, yeah, we'll trust this guy to topple the Ayatollah. I almost conscious of going on about it too much, but I don't think you can go on about it too much, because what the hell happens next time? These people are put... Do we add it to the list? Do we add it? We do, don't we? Boris Johnson, Brexit, Liz Truss, austerity, Donald Trump, war in Iran, genocide in Gaza. All the same people supporting all of it. And still, of course, the loudest voices and often the best rewarded contributors to public discourse. And in Nigel Farage's case, I think he's in favour of all of those things, isn't he? In Nigel Farage's case, still leading in the opinion polls. Majid's in Maidenhead. Majid, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I'm just giving you a bit about my background. I'm an Iraqi-born, what I call British citizen now. I've been in this country for 45 years. I came as a student when Iraq was a prosperous society.
Gosh.
And obviously, I've seen the Iraq-Iran war, the first one when Iraq was encouraged, or they encouraged Saddam Hussein to go and bomb the hell out of Iran, which is a new revolution, and what have you, and into the Iraq-Kuwait war, you know, first Gulf War. So I've seen it all. I've seen it all, and then in the sanction on Iraq and how America and allies literally bombed Iraq
back to the Stone Age was the phrase that I think they used. Was it, or was that Afghanistan? Yeah. I always forget.
Iraq as well. They put them back to the Stone Age.
The history is extraordinary. I mean, even little things that I, as a Westerner with an interest in these matters, but not with anything like the intellectual or the emotional investment or the familial investment that you have. You know, the fact that the West was on the same side as Iraq in the Iraq-Iran war, and then, of course, opposed to Iraq after Iraq invaded Kuwait, speaks to something, doesn't it? Inconsistent or something that's beyond pragmatism. It's entire pure self-interest, and yet we just watch history repeat itself. In this case, in Iran, now facing what Iraq faced years ago.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, Iraq was encouraged to go and move into Kuwait.
Yes.
But that's history. I mean, that history. then I was actually with all the propaganda about what's happening in Iraq and how the way they demonized the regime and there, and I started to believe in it, and I was really looking forward to the second wave of attacking Iraq, yeah. You know, with the weapon of mass destruction of and how Bush, you know, got the collision of the willing or whatever he called it. And guess what? I mean, I was all for it. Yeah, we need a regime change. Let's go for it. We do need a regime change. And then
it happened.
It happened, and that actually, you know, after it happened, and when I went back there, and I did go back, by the way, to just to visit because right. I do have a family there.
Yeah,
and it just the place. You know, when I left it, it was something. I know I live in 1979, so that was, a modern society. The education was, you know, first, if not the best in the Middle East, and the National Health Service. And you look at it, it's just, it is back to the Stone Age. The infrastructure is totally non-existing. You know, hospitals are, you know, people can't even go and get simple treatments. And then I saw it turning into a civil war. You know, people,
yes.
You know, the Kurds against the Arabs and the Arabs against the Kurds, and then the Shia against the Sunni and the Sunni against the Shia. And it just, it turned into an absolute disaster. And I lost two of my brothers into the civil war.
I'm sorry.
So it happened. So what I'm trying to say in here, you know, encouraging, the West encouraging, or America encouraging, with the help of the Israelis, and obviously that was Benjamin Netanyahu's dream, by the way. It has been his dream for the last 40 years, is to go through, you know, getting rid of Iraq, get rid of Syria, Libya, and his final list in his the seven wars, what they call it. You know, I've done lots of research about his ambitions. Is getting rid of Iran. It's about domination and domination of the Middle East, and you're free to do what you need to do there. So, really, my advice is not my advice. It's up to the
The benefits, the fruits of your experience, I suppose, and the message you send today to Iranians who welcomed absolutely. The attacks upon Iran is be careful what you wish for.
Absolutely, absolutely. Once they bomb it back to the Stone Age, I mean, I know they. I've been monitoring this because obviously it brings back memory, horrible ones. And so they are repeating it again. You know, once they leave, what kind of society are they going to leave behind, you know, after they do this? You know, bombing a hospital, bombing a school, and bombing all sorts of, you know, civilian infrastructure, it doesn't mean that's helping the society. It's
no,
actually
and,
not.
And yet, but of course, you were, I mean, this is why I'm grateful to you for ringing in today, because, as you said, you had been put into a place where you could welcome the original intervention, the original attempts at regime change in Iraq, but you are cognizant of what happened and what usually happens next. And that is the bit that baffles me. The absolute collective amnesia or ignorance or callousness, absence of concern for all of the lessons of recent, incredibly recent history in exactly the same part of the world. You must stick around today, Majid, because Arthur Snell is joining me at 12:30, and his first book, he's a former diplomat, literally explains how that decision to invade Iraq helped fuel sectarian violence and chaos in the region and created the conditions which, or the vacuum, if you like, into which ISIS later moved. That's not what his new book is about. He's coming in to talk about his new book, but he is something of an expert on Iraq and the Middle East, so I'm sure you and I and hopefully everybody else will be very interested in what Arthur has to say shortly after PMQs. The time now is 11:02.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Iran has stepped up retaliatory strikes on Israel and neighbouring Gulf countries as conflict in the Middle East enters a 12th day. At least three cargo ships have been hit in the Strait of Hormuz this morning. It's unclear who's targeted them, but Tehran has threatened to fire on any vessel in the key shipping route. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told a parliamentary committee this morning it's too early to know how the war will affect prices in the UK.
It's certainly not good for the British economy to have trade disrupted, and especially when so much oil and gas comes from that part of the world.
Rachel Reeves also told MPs that no option is off the table when it comes to shielding businesses and households from spikes in energy costs. Documents relating to Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the United States are due to be made public later. The government is releasing them over concerns about how the peer was vetted and what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. He denies any wrongdoing. Phone companies are being urged to make devices less attractive to steal. Britain's biggest police force wants to make resetting phones more difficult and the ability to block devices easier. The head of the Met Police has warned he will lobby the government to force companies to act if they don't respond by June. London's mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan, told LBC he's backing Sir Mark Rowley's call.
We're imploring the phone manufacturers, the mobile phone operators, the tech industry to work with us to do simple things to make a stolen phone useless. At the moment, you can reset a phone, you can reuse a phone, and you can resell it. Why not have a kill switch so a phone that's stolen can't be used again? Why not have visible serial numbers so we know, we can check the serial number to see if it's been stolen?
Competition for rental homes has fallen to its lowest February level for 6 years. The property website Zoopla says the average number of inquiries per home was 4.8% last month, down from 6.5% last year. And Warwick Davis is among those being honoured by Prince William at Windsor Castle. The actor was made an OBE in the New Year's Honours for services to drama and charity. In this city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 69 at 10,343. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy with outbreaks of rain for most. Some brighter spells developing later, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
We're here at Cheltenham with racing fans ready to play Coral's Reward Shaker. Listen to that roar! And with 100,000 free bets up for grabs every day at the Cheltenham Festival, they're all shaking. We've got the Tweeders shaking for a £5 free bet. The Flat Capper's bagging a free bet too. Oh, tidy! Play Coral's free Reward Shaker to win guaranteed rewards and special offers. Oh, that's rewarding. Coral, we're here for it.
18 plus, UK online only. Max one reward or offer per player per day. 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Reward restrictions, requirements and T's and C's apply. Gambleaware.org.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
They're not cliches by coincidence, are they? I mean, clever observations that become so baked into our collective consciousness that they edge ever closer to the realms of cliché, but those who do not learn from history are condemned forever to repeat it. Deserves a slightly better rep, doesn't it, than mere cliché? And it's a pearl. It's a pearl of wisdom. It's not foolproof. It's not an infallible observation, but was it Karl Marx who said that history repeats itself, first as tragedy, then as farce? I understand that as well, but I prefer the one about the history, not learning from history, condemned forever to repeat it. And that's what I find so extraordinary about the incredible support for Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's war in Iran from the get-go in this country, not from people who are part of the diaspora, not from people who've been driven to desperation by the hideousness of the Iranian regime, but by people who do what I do for a living, or people who are politicians in this country, your Kemi Badenochs, your Nigel Farages. I mean, speaking of Nigel Farage, the mess that the Brains Trust at the top of Reform UK is in, the only person who hasn't chipped in with a completely contradictory opinion on the war in Iran is 30P Lee, who, I don't know, I think for reasons that aren't too hard to speculate on, he's probably struggling to work out what day it is at the moment before he offers up an opinion on geopolitics or the Middle East. But I am truly, it doesn't happen very often that Eleanor and I get to work and look at each other with exactly the same sense of puzzlement several days running. What the hell is going on? What is wrong with these people calling for this war, despite having been there for Iraq? As our last caller just reminded us, despite having been there for Afghanistan, despite having been there for Libya and Syria, or whatever else example you want to bring up, and of course, having just watched Gaza be turned into a desert by Benjamin Netanyahu. And now we think they're going to act in Iran in the interests of the Iranian. What is wrong with these people? What is wrong with them? And of course, now they are reverse ferreting. Kemi Badenoch, I read this morning, has denied that she ever called for the UK to join the US-Israeli war on Iran. Which is odd, isn't it? Given how loudly she was shouting about Keir Starmer being weak for not joining the US-Israeli war on Iran. Andrew Neil, I think, is very much in the running for King Ferret. Kemi Badenoch in the running for Queen Ferret. It's a unisex crown, but obviously the title changes according to whether you are a man or a woman. So not that long ago, like, I don't know, 10 days, Andrew Neil was urging Donald Trump to stay the course and to carry on fighting and to be resolute. Here it is, the Middle East will never be perfect, but it could be much better than it is. So stay the course, Mr. President, wrote Andrew Neil in the Daily Mail. Today, he bangs a rather different drum, essentially describing the mess that the country finds itself in and the hideousness of the attacks undertaken by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Let me get you the headline, because this is one of your contenders for reverse ferret of the week. Trump has gambled his presidency on Iran, and right now it's far from clear the gamble will pay off. The other losers look like being the Gulf states, Ukraine, Taiwan, and, of course, Britain. The winners, Russia and China. So remember, these people are the best of us when it comes to commentary and analysis of international affairs. 8 days it's taken Andrew Neil to go from stating that the Middle East will never be perfect, but it could be much better than it is, so stay the course, Mr. President. And remember, these people sided with Donald Trump when he attacked Keir Starmer, made ludicrous comments about Winston Churchill. They sided with the foreign leader who wishes us nothing but ill over their own democratically elected prime minister. But even by the standards of reverse ferrets, this is supersonic. 8 days it's taken Andrew Neil to go from the Middle East will never be perfect, but it could be much better than it is, so stay the course, Mr. President, to the other losers look like being the Gulf states, Ukraine, Taiwan, and, of course, Britain. The winners, Russia and China. 8 days. And the rudeness that they reserve for people who have been proved right is absolutely off the charts. Kemi Badenoch, probably the rudest one of them all. Nigel Farage, he's another contender for King Ferret. Obviously, when Donald Trump shouts jump, Nigel Farage squeaks, how high? And of course, when the President of the United States of America is black, Nigel Farage insists that we mustn't pay any attention whatsoever to them and warned against any prospect of war in the Middle East. Just less than 10 years ago. So his reverse ferret is extraordinary. And of course, his brains trust the high command in his so-called political party can't even agree with each other about what they are doing or what they should be doing. Honest Bob Jenrick's opposed to it. Richard Tice is all for it. Nadeem Zahawi thinks we should be dropping bombs on Iran. Nadeem Zahawi, of course, hails originally from Iraq, so he's precisely the kind of Brit that some of his new friends in Reform want to have deported back to their country of origin, because he is an integrated refugee. I mean, the confusion is off the charts, but I'm just pointing out the reverse ferret element of it. And then we have Richard Call Me Dick Littlejohn, who has gone in the space of a week from being more ashamed to be British by Keir Starmer's refusal to join this war to being so utterly desperate for everybody to move on to something else that he started writing about lollipop ladies yesterday. Who would you like to vote for on King or Queen Ferret of this war? Is it Kemi Badenoch? Is it Nigel Farage? Is it Andrew Neil? Or is it Richard Littlejohn? And you can add other people to this list as well, if you want to. But please remember that I don't allow explicit criticism of my own colleagues here at LBC on this programme. So the reverse ferret of the week or the month, who is it going to be? Those are my four contenders, my four original contenders. You're welcome to add other names to the list if you can think of some. But I imagine that they're the top four, aren't they? I haven't really had a proper look at the Telegraph. There was that bloke yesterday who we put on Unhinged Headline, who was arguing that Vladimir Putin will be quaking in his boots because Donald Trump has successfully removed two dictators. A take on the situation so mutton-headed that I can only conclude that Hamish de Breton Gordon, for that is his name, is at least 52% sheep. I how else can so much of his head be made of mutton, unless he is actually genetically descended from Dolly, the cloned sheep? I don't even think he's done a reverse ferret. He's still somehow under the illusion that Vladimir Putin is going to be quaking in his boots because Donald Trump has replaced a dictator in Venezuela with his own deputy and an Ayatollah in Iran with his own son. And hey, Mr. Bretton Gordon gets paid for his opinions. And Andrew Neil gets paid for his opinions. And Richard Littlejohn gets paid for his opinions. And Nigel Farage gets paid for doing cameos, promoting gold bullion, cryptocurrency. He gets paid for everything. He also makes a few quid as an MP, but it's peanuts, frankly, compared to what he makes pursuing all his other interests. Cammy Badenoch, I suppose, out of the four, she's the only one that isn't getting paid technically for her opinions. She's getting paid to be the leader of the opposition, except she is no longer part of the opposition to Keir Starmer's original decisions, despite the fact that she was attacking them at PMQs all last week. Might be worth tuning in this week. Well, to be fair, you have to, because we'll be taking it live at 12 noon. But who is your favourite ferret? Your favourite ferret? Is it Cammy Badenoch, who has never been opposed to opposing this war, apparently? Is it Nigel Farage? He was all for it until he wasn't. Probably the closest one to a U-turn is Farage, who would be desperately hoping that Donald Trump hasn't found out that he has now completely changed his tune, having seen where public opinion was going. Is it Andrew Neil, who in the space of 8 days has gone from "stay the course, Mr. President," to "holy moly, it's an almighty disaster"? Or is it Richard Littlejohn, who's gone from "I've never been more ashamed to be British"? He wrote, well, I don't know where he is at the moment, but he spent an awful lot of his career writing about how awful Britain is from a gated community in Florida. But he's gone in the space of a week from "never been so ashamed to be British" to "please don't mention the war, I'm writing about lollipop ladies." Which of those is your favourite ferret? And we'll get back to the question of what the hell is wrong with these people, with a side order of, if you are Iranian or you are invested in the area, the country, the region, how are you doing? How are you doing? And no criticism from me, although some of your fellow countrymen and women may be a little bit more robust, but no criticism from me for being wrong, for having hope, born of desperation, that Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu would break the habits of two lifetimes and act in the interests of anybody other than themselves. Spoiler alert, they didn't. They haven't, and they never will. So how are you doing now, having been originally quite warm towards this intervention, waking up to the realization that it quite possibly, even perhaps probably, is going to make everything worse?
LBC. Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensified Pasta Sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato,
whoa,
and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify Pasta Sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1. Or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday, and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus, UK only, no purchase necessary.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It's 11:17. Spencer Silver was his name, and he worked at the 3M Corporation in the United States of America, and while attempting to develop a super strong adhesive, do you know what he accidentally invented? I discovered this morning as a consequence of a clue in the New York Times. Spencer Silver was attempting to develop a super strong adhesive in 1968 at the 3M Corporation, and as a consequence, he accidentally invented Post-it notes. And there is a Post-it note attached to my laminate of the Chilcot checklist, but it contains a very, very rude word that Eleanor wrote yesterday, having found my laminated Chilcot checklist in the recycling bin where I put my paperwork at the end of the programme. So we went in the space. This is an answer to a question I asked earlier in the programme. If you're wondering what on earth is going on, 4 hours it took me to lose my laminated Chilcot checklist, about which I was so excited yesterday. And as they didn't, but could quite conceivably say to me, this is why you can't have nice things, James. This is why you can't have nice things. So I spent all yesterday's show going, ooh, laminate, laminated, making jokes about Emily Maitlis getting everything she wants when I never get anything. And then I actually lost it. I threw it in a recycling bin by accident 4 hours after it was given to me. But Eleanor rescued it. So I have it in front of me. She put a very rude Post-it note on it saying, stop, bleep, binning everything, which is good advice that I will do my best to heed. And I get, as a consequence of that bizarre little moment in our working lives, I get to share with you the fascinating piece of trivia regarding Spencer Silver at 3M Corporation in 1968, attempting to develop a super strong adhesive and accidentally inventing the Post-it note. And that's why you tune in every day. That, of course, and the political commentary to which we return. Ramina is in Leeds. Ramina, what made you pick up the phone?
Thanks, James, for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to say I'm of Iranian descent. I have family in Iran. And I just wanted to articulate really that anyone who is anti-war, which I understand the real sentiment of against being against this war, I am routinely against all wars. But yeah. I think it's really important when people do that, that they also, in the same breath and at the same time and every single time, also state that they support the Iranian people's need for freedom from this brutal regime.
Yes.
And I don't feel like that's happening. I feel like the kind of anti-war brigade are just saying it to be anti-war rather than recognising that if this war ends and our people are left under a brutal regime with no support and the world's attention has moved on,
yes,
then what happens to them? Will they just continue to be murdered, raped and assaulted by this regime on a daily basis, of which the regime has killed more people than this war has killed, and no one seems to be paying enough attention to that?
I think, in their defence, I think that the letter that Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe and many others, including Aras Amiri, also held in jail in Tehran, and Nazrin Parvaz, who spent 8 years there from 1982, I think they do make that point. But you're absolutely right, and feel free to fill your boots on this programme. That the point is, of course, that things could end up even worse than they were before as a direct consequence of the war that many people welcomed because they thought that things would get better. It's an almost unbearable irony.
Absolutely. But I just think really, like, anyone that actually truly cares about Iranian people rather than just jumping on this political bandwagon or using it as a way to express their own ideology needs to, if they are going to call for an anti-war perspective, also call for the proscription of the Islamic Republic as a terrorist group and expel the diplomats from the UK whilst calling for a release of any political prisoners in Iran and crucially deplatforming anyone that speaks on behalf of the regime. There are lobbying groups across the world that speak on behalf of the regime, and I see them on the news all the time, one is calling them out.
I remember when people who I can't quite believe the identity of some of them were queuing up to take money from the regime to appear on press TV in this country, politicians and media figures alike. But I think under our current law prescribing the IRGC is not possible, but the cessation of diplomatic relations makes sense as well. The problem is, I suppose, this is often the argument when it comes to cutting off diplomatic ties with a country, is that then they become even more isolated and the regime becomes even more bedded in and oppressive. So it's sometimes a bit of a tightrope to walk. I sense from what you're saying that it's almost as if people on both, quote, sides, end quotes, of this are being vain They're indulging their own anti-war or pacifist credentials without actually stopping to think about where that would leave the Iranian people. But if we conclude that this war is going to leave the Iranian people in a worse situation than they were in before, that will be a consequence of both the people that waged the war and the regime that they failed to replace.
Yes, quite. And I feel, you know, profoundly upset as an Iranian person. I've been deeply upset by some of my friends who have suddenly paid attention to Iran purely because of the war,
yeah,
and have failed to pay attention to the decades of trauma caused by this regime. What I'm worried about is the spotlight will go off Iran. The regime will continue to do what it's been doing for years, and everyone will forget about it and stop talking about it. And that's my family. They're my people. And I would just hope that people actually who profess to care about humanity and justice continue to talk about human rights rather than just talking about the war.
And keep it in the spotlight. I suppose one fear, given the sort of vanity and egos involved, is that people like Donald Trump, and of course to a lesser extent the people who we are assessing for the scale of their reverse ferreting today, that they will want it to disappear from the spotlight because it will be a constant reminder of how hideously wrong they were to support this war in the first place. You can do both. You can be diametrically opposed to the war and passionately supportive of the Iranian people, but it's hard to know how, isn't it, for the average Brit who doesn't have Iranian heritage. How do you do it, Romina?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and I can see people who feel really passionate against the war, but they're not also sort of in the same breath saying that they support Iranian people, and not doing that is a massive whitewash for the regime, because if you just say stop the war, stop the war, stop the war, but don't say we also see the Iranian people and we will platform their experience and we will keep talking about it.
Help the Iranian people. I remember when Omid, I guess I've got two friends, well, I've got a few actually, but two that you'll have heard of Iranian heritage, Omid Jalili and the name's just temporarily eluded me. We were on Celebrity Mastermind together. So Shaparak, of course, Andy. They are both great upholders of the cause that you describe, constantly reminding people of the plight of the Iranian people. But it is, I guess, in this window of war, it's hard not to focus on the war. And you're right to remind us that we need to remember the plight of the people that are going to still be there when it's over, and quite possibly living in circumstances worse than we are living in now. What's on that list? So there's prescribed the IRGC, more sanctions on diplomats, but the problem with sanctions, of course, is that they hurt the people living in a country. Cutting off, calling for things is all that we can do, really, isn't it, politically speaking?
Yeah. And crucially, deplatform these people that speak on behalf of the regime. I've been really depressed to see so many journalists give a platform to people without challenging them. Actually, people that I normally don't think, I don't particularly like Piers Morgan, but I've actually seen him give a really good interview against some of these people. And I think sometimes a lot of other people are just really struggling to either do some background research on who is associated and lobbied, who works as kind of a lobbying part of the regime or not. And I just think journalists need to be really careful about who they're giving a microphone to.
I completely agree. I'm very lucky to have people like you listening to my program, so you can give me a bit of a shake if you think that I need it.
I will. Thank you.
I sense you might. Thank you, Romina. Take care. 11:26 is the time. And of course, I suppose it's excusable, if not inevitable, that the focus is on the violence, is on the war. But the question of what are we doing to help? What should Keir Starmer be doing to help? What should the UK government be doing to help the people of Iran, to which you once again, actually, Romina highlights the madness of the moment that we find ourselves in. We're going to help them by attacking them without a proper rationale or without proper reasons or without a proper plan or without a roadmap. God, it feels like months ago that we were reflecting upon what David Petraeus said in Iraq, tell me how this ends. What Colin Powell said, the late General Colin Powell said about the necessity of having a clear political objective if you went to war. And compare characters like that to the characters that are surrounding Donald Trump, people like Pete Hegseth, and of course Steve Witkoff and Trump himself. I think it was the Energy Secretary who announced yesterday that the Americans had escorted a oil tanker through the Strait of Hormuz, and then a few minutes later deleted it because they hadn't. And if you needed a better example of what I've been saying to you all along about the way that truth and fact are just completely destroyed now by these people, then you have it there. That's an absolutely cracking example of it. But Romina's absolutely right. Underpin all of this, caveat all of this, add to all of this questions about what is being done to help the Iranian people, what should be done to help the Iranian people, and what could be done. I think I'm a bit guilty of some of the things that she described. But I can vow to do better, which is all any of us can ever do. Unless, of course, you are in the business of reverse ferreting and never explaining and never apologising for it, which brings me to, who are you going to vote for the most violent ferret? Is it Kemi Badenoch? Is it Nigel Farage? I suppose he looks most like a ferret out of these four people, but I don't want you to allow that to influence your voting. Is it Andrew Neil or is it Richard Littlejohn? Whose reverse ferret on this war against Iran has been most humiliating and most violent? Badenoch claiming that she was never, ever in favour of it, despite, of course, attacking Keir Starmer at every opportunity. Nigel Farage, who's gone from saying we should do whatever Donald Trump wants us to do to saying that we shouldn't be involved at all. Andrew Neil, who's gone in 8 days from urging Donald Trump to stay the course to describing the absolute disaster that many people could see from a mile off. Or Richard Littlejohn, who has gone from explaining how he has never been more ashamed to be British by our failure to join this war to being so desperate to avoid talking about this war that he is now writing about lollipop ladies in the Daily Mail. It's coming up to 11:30. I've got room for a few more calls. Oh, well, two, in fact, on my switchboard. If you want to contribute to either of these conversations, one about how members of the Iranian population, both inside and outside Iran, are processing what has actually happened, as opposed to what you hoped would happen when this war began, or what you feared would happen when this war began. And the second one, my continuing obsession with what the hell went wrong. And those are the extreme examples, your Badenochs, your Farages, your Andrew Neils, your Richard Littlejohns, really pretty much being on brand, behaving in exactly the cowardly and querulous way that you have come to expect over the years. But for people of whom you expected more, what the hell went wrong with them when they started calling for international law to be ignored, or for Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu to be trusted? It's 11:30. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
A number of cargo ships have been hit in the Strait of Hormuz, the key trade route effectively closed by Iran. It's not clear where the projectiles came from, but President Trump had earlier warned Tehran not to lay mines in the strait. Documents relating to Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the US are due to be made public later. The government's releasing them over concerns about how the peer was vetted and what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. He denies any wrongdoing. And phone companies are being urged to make devices less attractive to steal. Britain's biggest police force wants to make resetting phones more difficult and the ability to block devices easier. LBC weather, cloudy with outbreaks of rain for most, some bright spells developing later, a high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades, and why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Imagine a breakfast wrap. You know the one, because there really is only one. Sausage, egg, cheese, bacon and a potato rosti all wrapped together. Yep, there it is. I think my work here is done. Served until 11 a.m.
The tax year end on April the 5th is approaching, so don't let your 2025-26 tax-free cash ISA allowance go to waste. Make the most of it with a 4.01% rate from Marcus by Goldman Sachs, the five-time Which-recommended savings provider that's backed by over 150 years of Goldman Sachs expertise. Open your Marcus cash ISA at marcus.co.uk. Time's ticking.
Interest rate is 4.01% AER, 3.94% tax-free variable, includes a bonus rate of 0.74% tax-free fixed for the first 12 months. Rate correct as of 5th of March 26.
This week at Lidl, you can afford to be mum's favourites. Treat her with a gorgeous Mother's Day bouquet from £1.89. And show your love with a bottle of Prosecco Spumante, only £5.99 with Lidl Plus. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus excludes England and Wales while stocks last. Offer ends 18th of March. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
33 minutes after 11 is the time. What's with this nasty attack on ferrets, writes P. Do pick on animals your own size. I'm not attacking ferrets, all right? I'm just using that phrase. It's a journalistic phrase, the reverse ferret. When you, I think Private Eye came up with it first. I can't remember why. It's when you just completely abandon a position that you were passionately espousing 10 minutes ago and start passionately espousing the opposite position. And there's a lot of it going on. But as Romina reminded us, possibly to the exclusion of the stuff that we should be caring about much, much more, which is the plight of the Iranian people who, I mean, they're in hell, aren't they? They live under a hideous regime, albeit a regime that approximately 20% of the population support. They live under a hideous regime, especially the women, and they are now being bombed by alleged war criminals. It defies distillation, really. You can't talk about a rock and a hard place. It sounds too inadequate. It sounds too trite. 26 minutes to 12 is the time. And, of course, a question that continues to obsess me is how on earth that analysis there, being attacked by two alleged war criminals, is one that was missed by so much of the commentariat and the political establishment in this country, unless they just don't care about such things. Maya is in Barnet. Maya, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, I'm Hello. Just calling today. I would like to say I'm not a political person at all, so I do not have the answer to a lot of your questions.
No
but
one
I'm just
does,
calling.
Maya. Nobody does. That's the point of asking them, so please don't worry about that.
Thank you. I have born and raised in Iran until I was 17.
Okay.
I have left the country and came here, since the war began, and even before, I have been in touch with a couple of my husband's cousins and my aunts and cousins, which if they only call, we can basically hear from them because there's an internet blackout.
Yes.
I've been asking them to please tell me. I have been advocating for Reza Pahlavi not because because I'm in the pro-war or anything. I've been advocating for Pahlavi for all my life because
This is the last Shah's son, for people who aren't clear.
Yes, because I totally understand. I think going back to Iran's history from Qajar, Iran has always been a dictatorship. And I think from what Mohammad Reza Shah picked up was quite a lot. At least he had a decent human rights. Not human, I'm not saying he had human rights. He had some human rights, let's say.
Okay.
I know that he was also a dictator at some point. And what I'm trying to say is what I've heard from from all my cousins, my aunts, and everyone, that some of them that actually were against Reza Pahlavi and now are actually with him.
Yes.
And I've told them, please let me tell me what you want me to share, and I will share. And they have all saying, if this regime is not gone, we will all be massacred. Let me tell you that my husband's cousin's friend, who was 18, had a very high score to go to the university, was killed at the age of 18 in the protest in January. My brother-in-law, from my cousin's side, my brother-in-law was raped anally 100 times, and he's an MS patient already, and he's now bedbound because of a simple protest 10 years ago. I personally was threatened to be shot in school, in my head, by a teacher that was showing us how to place a gun. This is 15 years ago when I was screaming for down with dictator in the school, a group of us, and she said she has the right to shot us right in the head. I can tell you that I have, what I'm trying to say is that I have always been not a fan of Netanyahu or Trump, particularly after what Trump said about paracetamol. I was like, what is nonsense is he saying about?
Well, he said about dead British soldiers, but I take your point. It depends what day it is, what we're going to focus on for the latest madness to come out of his mouth. So I understand why you're telling me that, and I just apologize for anybody who was taken by surprise by some of the very graphic descriptions that you just just provided, but it's important that we're aware of just how hideous this regime can be. And that explains why you would welcome any attempt to remove it. But Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu are not currently showing any signs of wanting to install Reza Pahlavi at the top of the country, and they're probably not going to do anything to stop the installation of the last Ayatollah's son. So where are you in the context of the latest events?
Confused.
Pardon?
I think you're all confused. It was really great that Khamenei was taken out on the first day, and then after that, I don't know what's going on after
that.
That's
the thing, isn't it?
Yes, they said our school and hospitals, probably some of them are attempted because people know that, we know that RGC is hiding in them, but for some of them, they've just been attacking because
They blew up the school by accident. I haven't even heard claims that the IRGC...
Oh, no, not that school only, right. Just in general, I'm talking.
So what do you think is going to happen next? And at what point do you think you might conclude, if there isn't an extraordinary turn of events, at what point do you think you might conclude that it would have been better if this had never been started at all?
I don't know. Because I genuinely don't know. But I think what every Iranian was hoping is for us not to turn into Afghanistan and Iraq, because we have, and this is why I say that people should not go ahead of themselves and think, oh, we should have a republic of some sort, because we are not Switzerland or we are not there yet. And this is why we think...
Well, this is what Pahlavi has offered to preside over a period of transition. But I mean, if I were Iranian, I'd be looking at Venezuela. And I'm afraid I would be selling those shares immediately, because Donald Trump ain't interested in installing anything like that in the country. He's interested, I suspect, in getting out now as quickly as possible and pretending that it never happened, because it has not delivered whatever it was he was hoping it would be delivered. Netanyahu is a different kettle of fish entirely, but only time will tell whether or not Iran ends up in similar straits to the other countries that you and many other callers have cited. But it might sound odd, given that what you described was so hideous and so traumatic. I'm grateful to you for reminding everybody listening of the hideousness of the regime, because Ramina as well up in Leeds really drove that point home, that because we're British... non-Iranian British, people like me, we are focused, I think, correctly and inevitably upon the wisdom or otherwise of joining in Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's war against the regime in your home country. And that is why some of the other factors will be pushed to the side of media and political contemplations, because the job or the question that the British people and the British government faces is what the British government should do in the very specific context of these attacks at this time. But you remind us of the ugliness of the bigger picture, Maya, and I'm very grateful to you for doing that, because, of course, if we were all Iranian, we would not be focusing quite so laser-like upon the simple question of supporting or not supporting the original attacks. I hope we talk again. Thank you. It's 20 minutes to 12. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Tara is in Highgate. Tara, what would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
I'd like to say, obviously, the war has been devastating to watch, really painful to watch. I've got Iranian roots. My parents lived there most of their life into their 20s. And I grew up in Germany, so I'm well aware of the devastation of war.
Yes.
I'm usually a pacifist. I'm sort of the type of person that wears a white poppy.
okay.
But, you know, in this instance, the US had promised to come to aid the people that were slaughtered in January during the protests. People have been trying to rise up against this terrorist regime for 47 years without any success. They get killed brutally. They have nothing. They have no weapons. They have nothing to defend themselves.
Mm.
And as previous people have said, you know, they get tortured, they get raped, they get killed. I've been to Iran several times myself a decade ago, but you live in constant fear of the arbitrariness of this regime.
Yeah.
You never know when they're going to pick on you, for what they're going to pick on you. There's sort of no real rule of law.
It's a state of hypervigilance. I mean, I've had this explained to me in the past, and I watched a couple of Iranian films last year, bizarrely, and that is something we don't really understand, in that you might see women walking around who aren't wearing their... their headscarves correctly, and they'll be entirely undisturbed and unmolested. And then just on the whim of a member of the security services, of the Revolutionary Guard, they could be rounded up and beaten. So there's, exactly, you never know. Exactly. You're in a state of constant terror, even when you're not actually being attacked.
And it's not just, you know, it's not just whether you wear your hijab. On some days, when they celebrate some of their marches, whatever, it's the colour of your headscarf that can get you into trouble.
Yeah.
Everything. People are being suffocated. They are being dictated what they can listen to, what they can read, what they can think, what they can say, what they can watch. They cannot breathe anymore, and they've been trying everything. I've been there for the Green Revolution. I've seen the protests in the street. I know, as you say, 80% of people do not want this regime anymore, and they are helpless. We are stuck between a rock and a hard place.
And that's why you would, or many people would, in the first days of this attack, have been hopeful. But I don't know that...
hopeful.
I don't know that many people are very hopeful anymore.
This is the thing. So, obviously, Donald Trump had promised surgical strategic strikes on the military. But for me, it really shifted when they hit that school. When innocent children get killed en masse. And I just cannot take civilian deaths as collateral damage. I don't think there should be mistakes made in hitting schools and hitting hospitals. We should still stick to the Geneva Conventions. Everyone has a responsibility of that. And I think, and obviously, we want the regime to go.
What are you? I mean, if you abandon international law and you abandon the Geneva Convention, what grounds are you actually fighting? What are you fighting for or in defence? I don't know that I can say that because it's not my family that are under the jackboot of the Ayatollah and his goons. But it does seem of paramount importance to the safety of the world that these rules are properly observed and properly enforced. And we live in a world at the moment where they've never felt weaker, Tara, not just in Iran, of course, but in Gaza and in Ukraine and in other parts of the world as well, in Sudan as well. I mean, it's a bleak picture, isn't it? I sense of given up hope that this particular episode or chapter of Iran's long history of resistance to the regime is going to end well.
And what you said is absolutely right. Neither Netanyahu nor Trump have the best interests of the Iranian people at heart.
No.
They always care for their own agenda. They always care for their own goals. They're not humanitarian saints, you know. We've seen that in Gaza. They don't stop at people's lives. So it's very scary that, you know, people actually wish for this intervention but what else are we going to do? How are we ever going to get rid of this regime? And how is this war going to stop? And a journalist in Germany used a really good analogy for this. She said, it's like the Iranian people are a woman that's been abused for years by her husband, brutally beaten to near death, right?
Mm.
And she finally manages to call the police for help. The police comes and shows up for a while and investigates, but then the husband manages to send them away again and say, everything's in hand, everything's okay. The husband's going to turn around to the wife and say, right, now I'm going to really show you. And so if, now that they've started this, if they just leave us high and dry without a regime change, that means the regime is going to get more and more brutal. And if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, like North Korea, then that's it.
I mean, you paint an incredibly bleak picture. It's one that we sketched out a little bit yesterday. All of the things that these people profess not to want, a bigger refugee crisis, more terrorism, and of course you then add to the list the possibility that 30 years of crying wolf about a nuclear capability might finally come true. I don't personally think that it's likely to happen, but, you know, the difference, the line between likely and possible is... It can sometimes be paper thin. Tara, I'm so sorry, actually. I should have said this sooner to all of the people. A preponderance of Iranian women calling me today. I don't know why that would be, but I just want to say that I'm so sorry for what all of you are going through here and, of course, what your families are going through at home. I'm also sorry that you have been so roundly abused by people who couldn't see how this war was going to end, by people who can't recognise that you can simultaneously despise the regime and recognise that these two men, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, are not going to rescue you from anybody, anything or anywhere. I hope I'm wrong on that. I still could be. You could be proved wrong. Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump may, for the first time in their lives, act in ways that are designed to improve the lives of people that can't vote for them or enrich them. But I don't see it myself. But I'm just so sorry for what you're all going through. I'm really reminded today of the danger of having an Anglo-centric view on the conversation. We probably should have done this Iranian-based phone in a little bit sooner, but we needed to see what happened. And now we are seeing what has happened, what is happening, and it's changed almost everything, except, of course, the absolute absence of integrity demonstrated by all of the people who insisted that it was a terrible mistake of Keir Starmer's not to get involved in this debacle. 12 minutes to 12 is the time. Speaking of Keir Starmer, PMQ's on the way at 12. Natasha will be joining me shortly to tee that up. And then in the final half an hour of the programme, Arthur Snell, something of an expert on the regions and the history of the regions that we've been talking about all morning, and turning his attention to the role that climate change is likely to play in the continuing diminution of humanity and dilution of international security. And Henry Reilly will be with us at 10 to 1 for the latest instalment of Reilly's Reform Roundup. It's like the stories just keep on coming. The time now is 10 to 12.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
That's back here at home, and the possibility of these digital IDs. It's back on track now, and a sort of people's panel to be established. Might have heard some of that coming from Darren Jones, who's chief secretary to the Prime Minister, one of the big advocates of the ID scheme. If the people's panel finds against it, can you give my listeners an assurance now that it would be scrapped if the panel goes against you and your colleague?
Well, it can definitely range
from
changes.
You can't say that, can you?
Well, it's a consultation.
What's the point of having a panel, chief secretary? You've already decided the outcome.
No. That's not true. That's not
true. So you will scrap it. If the panel finds against it, you will scrap it.
If we have unanimous feedback in the consultation.
But what about the majority? 52 place 48, numbers you might remember.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low, slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
At AJ Bell, we believe every customer deserves brilliant service, which is just one reason we're rated excellent on Trustpilot. And we all trust pilots, with their smooth, captainy voices that make you feel like you'd let them land anywhere they like. Sorry, where was I? Right, AJ Bell, rated excellent by sexy pilots. I mean Trustpilot. I'm a flight risk. AJ Bell, feel good investing. The value of your investments can go up or down.
My name is Karen, and this is my NHS story. You don't realise how blind you are until you have cataract surgery. I was referred to a surgical hub, and they booked us in for an operation. It was about 3 weeks before I was there. It's very, very quick.
The government is opening more surgical hubs, with more than 120 already operating across England, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS fit for the future.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys.
Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 11:52, and we have a runaway winner in our King or Queen Ferret competition this morning. I'm looking at four public figures who were all adamant that Keir Starmer should be standing alongside Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu in their probably illegal war in Iran, and they have all now reverse ferreted, abandoned their original position to varying degrees of humiliation. I asked you whether Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage, Andrew Neil, or Richard Littlejohn deserved the crown. It's a little bit unfair, this competition, because a lot of you are texting to tell me that you've got no idea who Richard Littlejohn is. He's a columnist in the Daily Mail, and I think the only columnist in history to be cited at an inquest into a suicide of someone he'd attacked in print by the coroner. The coroner cited him for special mention after somebody he'd attacked in print committed suicide. That's probably what he's most known for, I think. But anyway, I accept that you can't really vote for someone that you're not aware of. Andrew Neil comes in third place. So it's a toss-up at the moment between Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage for King or Queen of the Reverse Ferret this week. And I shall reveal the winner before PMQs. I'll give you a slight hint here. It's a clear victory. There is clear blue water between the second place person and the first place person in answer to the question of who has undertaken the most humiliating, abject and dignity-free reverse ferret on the question of war in Iran. But it is to the more serious question that we return our attention next, and that is the question of how do you deal with this if you saw the war as an unlikely but solitary chance of removing this hideous regime, removing the Ayatollah. It's like Hydra. Is it the Hydra? In Greek mythology, when you chop off one head and five more heads grow, or two more heads grow, they've killed the Ayatollah, meet the new one. It's his son, reportedly even more hardline. And as I think it was Tara reminded us with that chilling analogy, that if you are Iranian and you have dared to resist or stand up to the regime, then there is a hard rain coming, because Trump and Netanyahu aren't going to help protect you from whatever the new regime has planned for its enemies within. Sash is in Bexley. Sash, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. Yeah, long-time fan since the pre-Brexit days.
Thank you.
Really good to speak with you on the radio.
Likewise.
What made me pick the phone? This topic that you brought up, and I've been listening to this since 10 o'clock, right, because when you started the show. I mean, it's quite clear why you have Trump and Netanyahu, attacking Iran. And that's because, both are facing scandals at home. Both are trying to escape from their troubles from home. And I feel for the Iranian people because, especially hearing the stories that were, from the last three callers that you had on the show. Unfortunately, this isn't a fight of good versus evil. This is a fight of two evil sides. There's going to be no winner. But there's a clear loser, and that's unfortunately the Iranian people.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? You've got two hideous sides fighting, ostensibly fighting each other, and all of the collateral damage is suffered by the entirely and wholly innocent, who are actually under attack from both sides.
Exactly.
Within and without. It's horrible. It's unbearable.
And the unfortunate part is that, I think apart from the Spanish PM, probably the only one who really spoke out against the war, everybody else has been more a silent spectator. Yes, Keir Starmer was absolutely spot on in not joining the war. But he hasn't spoken out against the war either to say, this wasn't the way. I mean, he probably said something towards that when he said that you don't change your regime from the skies. But there's not been many people who have actually, had the guts to really speak out against what Trump and Netanyahu are trying to do.
I will still, because I still mean it, but it doesn't. I don't feel it as strongly as I would have done a few months ago, let alone a few years ago. The requirements of diplomacy, Sash, matter. I mean, that there is still a belief, whether or not it's forlorn or not, that you have to manage Trump. You have to manage the President of the United States of America, whoever it is. So you don't help him in his illegal war. And then when the facts change, you change your position legally, because it's a very different question of whether or not you should help attack positions that are attacking us or our allies, but I don't know what would have been gained by Keir Starmer coming out more with more explicit verbal condemnations. I suppose what I'm saying, mate, is I think his actions have actually spoken louder than the Spanish Prime Minister's words.
True. I get the diplomacy point. And I was for all of that in the first year of Trump's presidency when he kept making disastrous comments all over the place and everybody was, you know, being polite to him. But I feel he's a bully.
Well, for sure. And a coward, like all bullies. He's also a massive coward.
Because you can see, you know, if he comes up against another bully like Putin and he goes, you know, completely a cat in front of Putin, right?
Yes.
And at some point, you got to stand up to the bullies. Is the only way. That's the only way you can actually stop them in their tracks. And I don't think, you know, I'm not trying to say Keir Starmer should have been the one doing it, but probably EU alongside Britain should have probably taken a stronger stance together, because that's probably the other big block you have.
But then you're worried about Ukraine, and if the big man-child has a hissy fit, or it could be Ukraine that pays the price, already being inadequately supported by the United States of America. But if I was in the room where it happens, I would come out and say to you, we have to, look, he's a hideous man, don't tell him I said so, but we have to keep him sweet, because otherwise he might have literally just a temper tantrum and withdraw even more support from the Ukrainian people, or insult Volodymyr. Well, he's already insulted Volodymyr Zelensky last week, and we're so used to it now, nobody noticed he compared him to P.T. Barnum.
Yep.
I hear exactly. you. And another reminder, a really important reminder from Sash, that the Iranian people, the Iranian population, have gone from being attacked by their own regime to being attacked by Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. And you're almost asking them to pick a side. Who would you rather be shot by? It's just a heartbreaking scenario. Truly, truly heartbreaking. Thank you to everyone who's rung in today. I really feel we've gone places that we hadn't got to before, and there's no earthly way I can do that on my own. So thank you all. It's coming up to 12 noon. I should reveal the winner. So, actually, a quick word to Matthias, who is very cross. He says the election was rigged from the start because he voted for Richard Littlejohn. He wrote, I vote for Little Richard John. His avoidance of the subject betrays a conscience and shame about his original comments that deserves to be put on a pedestal and pointed out as widely as possible. But he can't win, can he? If a lot of people are getting in touch, say they don't know who he is. Matthias goes on, Kemi never knowingly made any sense, and this is no different. Farage doesn't deserve this kind of attention, and I don't really know enough about Andrew Neil to assess how in or out of character his reverse ferret is. I wasn't claiming it was unanimous. I was just saying that Littlejohn has come in fourth, Andrew Neil has come in third, Kemi Badenoch has come in second place, and wait for it. Nigel Farage is the winner, because Nigel Farage said on March the 2nd, we should do all we can to support the operation. I want to make that perfectly clear. He went further, in fact, about how, essentially, if Donald Trump shouts jump, then Nigel Farage believes it's the job of the British Prime Minister to shout how high. And now he said that we shouldn't be involved in any foreign wars at all. So Nigel Farage, in the space of a week, has gone from saying we should do whatever Donald Trump wants us to do, we should be involved in the war, we should be getting absolutely up to our ears in it, to saying that we shouldn't be involved at all. So King Ferret today is, perhaps unsurprisingly, Nigel Farage. And, of course, his brains trust at the top of the party are now arguing with each other about what they have and haven't said and what their so-called policy regarding this incredibly important matter of international war should be. I'm trying to find you the other quote, actually, on the one that really highlights... Oh, it's time for PMQs!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Why does the Prime Minister think now is the right time to increase the cost of petrol?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we are not increasing the cost of petrol. We're absolutely clear in taking the measures that are necessary to deal with the impact of the conflict in Iran. We're dealing with that with other allies. We're taking the necessary action. But the best thing that we can do, Mr. Speaker, is to work with others to de-escalate the situation. And Mr. Speaker, as I said to the House last week, I took the decision that we should not join the initial US-Israeli offensive against Iran. The leader of the opposition attacked me for that decision relentlessly. She said that the UK should have joined the US and Israel in the initial offensive strikes. Mr. Speaker, then yesterday, in the wake of the economic consequences, the leader of the opposition totally abandoned her position. She told the BBC, "I never said we should join." She told the BBC, "I haven't said we should have gone in with the United States." That is the mother of all U-turns on the single most important decision a Prime Minister ever has to take, whether to commit the United Kingdom to war or not.
Mr. Speaker, I think the mother of all U-turns is him saying that they're not increasing fuel duty. That is news to us, because last week the Chancellor stood up and said the fuel duty was going to increase in September. Yeah. The Prime Minister told us at the start of the year that the cost of living was his number one priority. So can he explain how a rise in fuel duty helps with the cost of living?
Mr. Speaker, fuel duty is frozen. It's going to remain frozen until September. And we will keep the situation under review in light of what's happening in Iran. But, Mr. Speaker, the most important issue is de-escalating the situation. And I come back to the Leader of the Opposition's position, because this is one of the most important decisions a Prime Minister or Leader of the Opposition ever has to take, whether to commit your country to war. The day after the initial US-Israeli strike started, her shadow foreign secretary said that the US-Israeli initial attacks were absolutely right, and it is a position my party supports. She said, why has the Prime Minister not actually worked with America to be much more proactive? Last Wednesday, Leader of the Opposition. We are in this war whether we like it or not. What is the Prime Minister waiting for? Then yesterday she says, I never said, I know they don't want to hear it. I know they don't. I wouldn't want to hear it if I were them. After all that, she says,
the order, order.
She says,
the order, order. Enough is enough. I can't hear it. Who wants to lead the first ones out? Right, we'll have a little bit more silence, Prime Minister.
So after 9 days of saying, join the war, join the war, join the war, yesterday she says, I never said we should join. I haven't said we should go in with the US. I'll tell you what's happened, Mr. Speaker. She and the Reform leader have been spooked because they realise they've jumped into supporting a war without thinking through the consequences. And now she's furiously trying to backpedal.
The Prime Minister seems to be asking last week's questions. This week, I'm asking about fuel duty. He has said that he wants to help... Mr. Speaker, he has said that he wants to help with the cost of living. My constituents live in a rural area. They rely on their cars to get to the shops, take their kids to school, see their elderly parents. And they tell me the rising cost of petrol is the single biggest cost affecting family finances. So does the Prime Minister not understand how important cars are to people in rural areas, or does he just not care?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we're working across all departments and with allies to deal with the impact of the conflict in Iran, as the House would expect. But she says about... If I'd asked her last week, her position would have been, we support the initial strikes and we want to join the war. This week, she says, we don't want to join the war. I'm sorry, that is a screeching U-turn. And Mr. Speaker, this is... In this job, You don't get a second shot at making the right call on taking your country to war.
We are actually having a steward's inquiry now on who has undertaken the biggest reverse ferry. Kemi Badenoch not challenging Nigel Farage.
Parliament a week later to say, oh, sorry, I got that one wrong.
Order! I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, but unfortunately, we've got to stick to Prime Minister's questions, not opposition questions. Kemi Badenoch.
Mr. Speaker, he said if I were Prime Minister, HMS Dragon would have left a week ago. The only time... Mr. Speaker, the only time he's taken decisive action was stopping Andy Burnham from standing in the by-election. But let's talk about what the people out there are worried about. I heard from a builder, Mr. Speaker, who has 115 employees using 75 vans. With the jobs tax, sky-high energy bills, and now a hike in petrol prices, that builder is having sleepless nights. How does the Prime Minister justify a rise in fuel duty to that small business owner and millions more like him up and down the country?
Prime Minister.
There hasn't been a rise. It is frozen. There isn't going. It is frozen until September. And Mr. Speaker, she mentions the HMS Dragon. Can I first start by thanking the Royal Navy who are serving on HMS Dragon? Can I second say that what's been happening is it's been carefully being loaded with the anti-strike ammunition and capability that it needs. And the Navy and civilians have been working 22-hour shifts in relationship. But in relation to those that are taking the action to defend us, what does she say? Just hanging about. Just hanging about. That's how she described our pilots in the region. Let me tell you what they've been doing. Flying sorties in 7 of the 10 countries in the region, day and night, taking out incoming strikes, protecting the lives of others whilst risking their own. If she had any decency, she'd get up and she would apologise.
Mr. Speaker. Oh, hang on. I think they should wait for it. Mr. Speaker, I have never criticised our armed forces. I have criticised him.
Order. Mr. Swallow, you're going out. I've had enough. Week in, week out. I believe Noel Naimi. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I have never criticised our armed forces. I am criticising him and his decisions. Yeah. And let me remind the House, Mr. Speaker, about his record on the armed forces. This is the same man who worked with Phil Shiner, a traitor to this country, who made up evidence to put our soldiers in prison for crimes they didn't commit. That is his record, so I wouldn't take any lectures from him. And by the way, military families are also worried, the ones in this country, about petrol prices. He's got nothing to say on that. And there's another group of people, Mr. Speaker, who have been hammered by this government. Farmers. I spent all last year telling the Prime Minister that his family farms tax was killing British farming. Now, those farmers are being punished with higher fuel prices. Does the Prime Minister think that's fair?
So, Mr. Prime Speaker, no apology to our pilots who are risking their lives. And I'm not going to take lectures from someone who says we should join the wall. And a week later says, can I change my mind? I got that wrong. It is deeply embarrassing. And she's not the only one. Mr. Speaker, last week she's not the only one. The leader of reform. We should be part of this with the US and the Israelis. We have to get rid of the regime. We should do all we can to support the operation. I make that perfectly, perfectly clear, he said. Until yesterday, screeching U-turn, we shouldn't get ourselves involved in another foreign war. Two parties packed with failed Tories led by leaders who are not fit to be Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, he doesn't want to talk about fuel duty because he has got absolutely no answers. The Conservatives are on the side of farmers. We are also on the side of drivers. We froze fuel duty every year from 2011, and in fact, we cut it in 2022 because we care about the cost of living. Labour think drivers are a cash cow. And now, Mr. Speaker, they think the drivers are a cash cow, and now they're hiking fuel duty for the first time in 15 years. Yeah. Everyone in this house knows the pattern. First, he'll march his backbenchers up the hill. Yeah, yeah. Then they'll be forced to defend fuel duty rises in the local elections. Then there'll be another humiliating U-turn. Yeah. So why doesn't the Prime Minister just stand up, admit he's got it wrong again, and scrap the fuel duty hike now?
Mr. Speaker, in the last 2 weeks, I've made two of the most important decisions a Prime Minister can make. The first is that we should not join the war in Iran. The second is we should protect British lives and the British national interest. The leader of the opposition decided that we should join the war against Iran. A week later, that we should not join the war against Iran and to insult our armed forces. She has utterly disqualified herself from ever becoming Prime Minister. Thankfully, she never will.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the Prime Minister knows, my mum proudly worked in the pot banks of Burslem and Tunstall and is watching at home right now. Now, tomorrow is International Day of Ceramics, and that matters deeply to Stoke-on-Trent, the historic heart of Britain's ceramic industry. And Newcastle-under-Lyme. With energy prices rising again due to global instability, will the Prime Minister please tell my mum and our fellow Stokies what additional support the government will give energy-intensive industries like ceramics so the kilns of Stoke-on-Trent can fire for generations to come?
He raised a really important issue, and I know that not only will his mum be watching, but his constituents, who he serves very, very well. Our supercharger will significantly reduce costs for thousands of major industries. Eligibility for the scheme is being reviewed this year. I can tell my honourable friend we're working with the ceramics industry on whether the scheme can be extended to more firms. Under the last government, industrial energy prices doubled and over 1,000 jobs were lost in the sector. We will not tolerate that.
Said David, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I pay tribute to the honourable member for Warrington North for her powerful and courageous speech in the debate on jury trials yesterday. I really hope the Prime Minister was listening. Mr. Speaker, 30 years ago this week, a man carried four handguns into Dunblane Primary School and murdered a teacher and 16 children. I was deeply moved by the BBC documentary about it last night and the courage of the parents who campaigned for a ban on handguns to keep other children safe, including Mick North, who lost his five-year-old daughter Sophie on that dark day. He's rightly called on the Honourable Member for Clacton to renounce his description of the handgun ban as, and I quote, ludicrous, something the Member still refuses to do. And Mr. North has also called for a review of firearms legislation to close any loopholes. Does the Prime Minister agree?
Prime Minister.
Well, I certainly do, and we must never forget the horror of Dunblane. And never forget the young children and their teacher who did not come home from school. The campaign that families fought to make this country a safer place is a lasting legacy, and we should be enormously grateful for their courage.
Yeah. Sir Ed Davey.
The Prime Minister for his reply, and I hope the government will close any loopholes. Mr. Speaker, this week families across the country have seen petrol prices rise at the pump, mortgage rates go up, and fixed energy deals get more expensive, all because of a war they did not start and do not support. The Leader of the Conservatives has been competing with the Honourable Member for Clacton to be Donald Trump's biggest cheerleader. And the Prime Minister was right to reject their costly warmongering. But last week, I asked him to guarantee that energy bills won't rise by hundreds of pounds in July. He didn't answer. So let me try again. Will he give people that energy bill guarantee now?
Prime Minister.
Can I thank him for raising this? Because people will be really worried about the impact on them. And just to reassure households that the cap is in place until the end of June, until July, and therefore that deals with the situation for households there. We are working with the sector and with others and with allies to do everything we can to make sure those energy bills don't rise. So we're working around the clock on that. The most important thing, the most effective thing we can do is to work with our allies to find a way to de-escalate the situation. He's right about the Leader of the Opposition, the Leader of Reform. Last week, they were urging us to join... This is serious. To join... If they had been leading the country, we'd be in a war. And they've now come to Parliament to say, oop.
Order, order, order. Prime Minister, who said lying again? I want that withdrawal.
I didn't.
Is that withdrawal? And I'll deal with it, thank you. I don't want any more off the front bench. We take it very seriously, and calling another member of light is not acceptable. Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and so that's our position.
Josh Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Whoa.
Too often I hear from
This is The Simpsons, isn't it? When someone's getting beaten up and they say, stop it, he's already dead, sprang to mind. Anyway, if you missed that, we're just going to recap briefly on Kemi Badenoch's contributions to PMQs this week.
Don't mention the war. I mentioned it once, but I think I got away with it all right.
It's 12:18.
This is LBC.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
My name is Chevy, and this is my NHS story. Over a couple of days, I was getting quite intense pain on the left side of my stomach. So I called my doctors and then was referred to the Eltham CDC. It was literally a seamless, stress-free day. There was no anxiety or worry.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
A Thames Link train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids tickets for £2 at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Proud partner of Team GB.
20 minutes after 12 is the time. Shall I rattle through some texts? Because it is not pretty. Kemi Badenoch, perfect example of the Dunning-Kruger effect, says Keith. Not that one. Oh, my word, James, every week I don't think Kemi Badenoch can get any worse, and every week she outdoes herself. What is she actually on about? Is she okay? There's a huge war in the Middle East, and she's talking about fuel duty rising, even though it hasn't risen. So, so bad. And that's from Jordan, although he signs it Bernard Manning in Devon. For once, please praise Starmer. I praise Starmer quite a lot, Louise. Please, 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 I am beyond grateful he is leading our country. That Badenoch person is an embarrassment. For the love of God, somebody, says Darren, take Badenoch's spade off her to stop her digging any deeper. Badenoch is embarrassing, says Jason, completely at sea. Nigel points out, not that one, Badenoch is not having a good month. Abby says, James, I came wide awake when I heard Kemi Badenoch ask about fuel duty. Does she not know what is happening in the Strait of Hormuz? I know she is stupid, but our questions on fuel duty today shows the level of her stupidity. Badenoch says, Andrew Kneeling is pant-wettingly awful. She can't get off her scripted attack line. Trisha asks, oh boy, is this her worst yet? Jennifer writes, wow, just wow, and not in a good way. Dave writes, this is the most excruciating performance, and by Badenoch standards, that's quite impressive, to be fair. And Mick says, says, to paraphrase The Simpsons, stop, she's already dead. Worst performance ever from the newly crowned Queen Ferret. And so, no, she was in second place. Farage's reverse ferret is still more humiliating than Badenoch's, even though... Anyway, someone in number 10 says, Isaac has clearly been listening to your show, James, but that doesn't explain why Kemi Badenoch created a bear trap and then climbed into it herself. And finally, Ryan says, is it just me that finds it really grating when Badenoch gives a little giggle when her backbenchers are chuntering behind her? It seems simultaneously arrogant and trivialises the proceedings. Well, it's funny that you should ask that, actually, because Ollie has also been in touch to say that little laugh Badenoch does when she gets a cheer from her own side, even on very serious matters, says that she's just in it for the clicks and not the interests of the country. So, Ryan, to answer your question, no, it's not just you. It's at least Ollie as well. And I suspect many others. Natasha Clarke is here. I mean, listen, that was two entirely independent conversations. Keir Starmer talking about the war, Kemi Badenoch, really desperate to talk about anything else.
Don't mention the war,
she almost said.
She did. Look, yeah, you're right. They could have been having two parallel PMQs with two different weeks. They could have even been facing other people. We don't know.
But he's got her bang to rights today.
Yeah, and look, I disagree with you on the idea that fuel duty isn't related to the war. I do think that we will be having a conversation in a couple of months' time about what fuel prices look like.
But she knows where the petrol comes from. She was in favour of a war in the Middle East.
Yeah,
and now she's complaining about a rise in petrol
prices. For sure,
price,
and so that is a totally hypocritical.
Do you think she knows? A genuine question. Do you think she knows where petrol comes from?
I haven't asked her, but I'll put that at number one as my top.
So fuel duty will be a valid line of inquiry in 2 months' time.
But I think Starmer is completely right to not say what he's going to do about fuel duty in 4 months' time. We've been in this war for 12 days. Yes. She can't really be expecting the government to go any further. And I thought Starmer's line was completely reasonable. He said, we will keep the situation under review in light of what is happening in Iran. That is the furthest that any government can really go at the moment, because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen in days' time, let alone months' time. The government have, in the last 24, 48 hours, signalled very clearly that they are prepared to intervene if they need to. And I do think we'll be in a position where, if in September the fuel duty cut, the 5p cut, is still due to come to an end, I am sure, absolutely sure, that the Treasury will be looking to cancel that. I think that is completely
No one she
fair.
Can claim again another win, because she
For
mentioned
sure.
it once,
yeah,
and therefore
exactly.
it's
she
proof
said it
positive
a long, long
that they
time
wouldn't,
ago, so
they wouldn't have done it unless she'd mentioned it once. But, I mean, in the annals, and listen, to be clear, we have been, or I have been, quite praising of Kemi Badenoch on occasion in recent weeks. She's improved immeasurably from an admittedly dismal starting point, but that was right back to the glory days of her being the worst ever leader of the opposition
Not
at
fantastic.
PMQs.
She seemed, you know how she always loves to criticise Keir Starmer for not deviating from his script? She didn't deviate from hers at all, did she? She's got her six questions and she wanted to press him on fuel duty and again, and it did feel that she didn't want to get involved in what the Prime Minister was saying. Of course he would obviously want to pressure on her changing, convoluted, slightly odd position on the war, which has changed and been very confusing. And I remember sort of...
Natasha.
Don't mention the war.
Carry on.
Okay. Well, does that mean I can't mention it either?
Oh, right, you can. Okay. But you can't mention her not mentioning it. You can mention her not...
But a week ago, she was...
Could she have owned it? I mean, she just jumped the gun, if you pardon the pun. Not quite as violently as Nigel Farage, who, of course, said that we should... be fully supportive of whatever the Americans are doing. We should be literally doing everything that we can to assist them. But she's absolutely on the hook for this, and she didn't need to be.
No, and but, you know, I remember sort of last week when she was being repeatedly asked, "Well, you've said the government need to go further. What do you want to see? Do you want to see us take part in these strikes? Yes or no? Do you want to be seeing?" And I think the phrase she used is, "We want to see them take them out." At source, and we want to see the government go far, far further than they are. It's hard to read that anything else apart from we do want to get them to get involved. And as you say, you know, now 11 days on, that's looking like, you know, comments that really shouldn't be made by a prime minister.
Is Farage there today? It'll be interesting to see if he goes, because he said, of course, on the 2nd of March, we should do all we can to support the operation. I make that perfectly, perfectly clear. And then making it perfectly, perfectly clear yesterday that he doesn't think we should be involved in another foreign war at all, which is why he did beat Kemi Badenoch to the reverse ferret crown, because she has, I mean, had she chosen to address the issue, she had a tiny, tiny little bit of room for
She had more wiggle room
maneuver,
to manoeuvre than
he did. More than Farage
exactly.
does.
Exactly. So Farage Nigel Farage does win your ferret award for sure.
Because King Ferret.
King Ferret. Does he get a crown? Do we get to award him something?
We're going to get one laminated.
Good.
We're going to get a crown laminated. It's like a Christmas cracker crown, but laminated. So it'll last for longer. It'll last forever. Yeah. If this was a left-wing politician, a Labour politician, which doesn't necessarily mean left-wing these days, but if this was a Labour politician that had accused our pilots and our military in the Middle East of hanging around, then it would be front page of the Daily Mail tomorrow. If it was Jeremy Corbyn...
Who was the Labour MP that insulted Emma Gent Code, that got a lot of stick for when she had talked disparagingly about Prince Harry not doing anything when he was serving.
Not only did Kemi Badenoch insult them all, she then lied about it.
Hanging around.
This would be huge if it were a Labour politician, but we'll wait to see whether the editor of the Daily Mail, Ted Verity, decides to give Kemi Badenoch the treatment that they would definitely give to a Labour politician who behaved in a similarly shameful fashion.
And you've got Ed Davey as well saying, I'm going to start by paying tribute to all of our armed forces. And, you know, Keir Starmer has incredibly strong argument on that one when he's talking about HMS Dragon. I don't think anybody out there will go, oh, could we not have moved a bit quicker? But the idea that Kemi Badenoch would have managed to send HMS Dragon off a week earlier, I think, is a bit for the birds. It's just not
Well, it wouldn't have had any weapons on it.
Exactly. She would have been carrying potatoes to the Middle East. Nothing going.
Which is, again, an unfortunate intervention from her. So we've got her not knowing where petrol comes from and pledging to send a ship that was not armed to the Middle East.
Not ready. You know,
insulting our armed forces.
Yeah. 22 hours a day. How could you, maybe the decision should have been taken earlier, and I think a lot of people do think that, but go on.
All while insisting throughout.
Don't mention the war.
Thank you, Keith.
Very good. But it was interesting to have Keir Starmer. Obviously, he's been on the back foot in terms of his U-turns repeatedly over the last 6 months. I think he really enjoyed having one from her. He really enjoyed going, you're changing position is here. You've changed your mind here. Own it. And like you say, she didn't want to go there, did she?
This will be added to the canon, won't it? This won't be the last we hear of it from either of them, because it is the biggest test a prime minister faces. They both failed it spectacularly.
Yeah, and I think people will look back at that sort of last week and their confusing positions. And I think a lot of people will be sort of hesitant of, do I want to vote for these people? Do I want to vote for these parties that potentially are all over the place on their foreign affairs? Both parties have very, very, very different views to what I think the public do. And I think Keir Starmer getting a lot of flack for what his position has been in the last week, but actually the public are with him. Callers are with him. People do not want to be involved in a foreign conflict. They do not want to be involved in airstrikes with the US and Israel. I think Keir Starmer, despite those reports that we saw last week where it felt like he may have been pushed into that position, but actually, his cabinet responsibility, that is what a government
does. International law. If you read the letter he wrote in 2003, there's no earthly way he was pushed into this. It's in his DNA.
But it's also just natural good politics to talk to your MPs and your cabinet about what they think and what they think their Labour members and Labour MPs will think about this too, for sure.
A lot of love for your potatoes gag. So while you're on a roll, do you know what this is?
Duking.
Pardon?
Duking.
Sorry? Duking. Excuse me?
It's the sound of a ferret noise. Ferret makes.
You knew that?
I didn't. I had to look it up.
I love this. You prepared for PMQs by looking up the word to describe the noise that a ferret makes.
Yeah. It's quite sweet, isn't it?
Let's have some fun, actually. So, no, press whichever button you want, Keith, all right? So it can be either the John Cleese one or the ferret one. So we cross live now to Kemi Badenoch.
Don't mention the war.
And Nigel Farage.
Nice.
Back to Kemi Badenoch.
Can we
don't mention the war.
Oh, Nigel Farage wants to get on the show again.
Can we make this a regular feature just so we can hear the duking?
I think we might, actually.
They don't smell very nice, ferrets, you know.
And on that bombshell, there's Amelia Cox with the rest of the news.
Kemi Badenoch has accused the Prime Minister of having nothing to say on petrol prices, with plans to end a freeze on fuel duty still due to go ahead. But Sir Keir Starmer hit back at the criticism, saying she jumped into supporting the war in Iran but is now backpedalling. Three cargo ships have been struck in the Strait of Hormuz as the key shipping route, which has been blocked by Iran. It's not clear who was responsible, but Donald Trump has previously warned Tehran not to lay mines in the strait. And files relating to the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson as US ambassador are due to be released this afternoon. Downing Street has agreed to publish them over concerns about what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. LBC weather, breezy with sunny spells and possible showers in the south. Windy further north with blustery showers, a high of 13 degrees.
Hear every side of the story. This is LBC.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Whether you still own it or not, if you had a diesel car built between 2009 and 2020, you could be entitled to compensation. Checking takes minutes at jointheclaim.com, and if successful, compensation could be worth thousands. Diesel emissions claims are still open for Ford, Nissan, Renault, Mercedes, BMW and Jaguar Land Rover. Don't miss out. Join millions of drivers across the UK. Check your vehicle now at jointheclaim.com.
Join the claim!
BetMGM was born in Vegas. So just like the Cheltenham Festival, we know a thing or two about entertainment. Every ride, every race, every roar. This is Cheltenham Vegas style. Sign up to BetMGM now. Bet £10 and get £40 in free bets. That's right. Bet £10 and get £40 in free bets. Are you ready for the greatest show on turf? BetMGM. It's showtime.
Minimum stake £10 and customers only. Wagering requirements and conditions apply. 18 plus. Please gamble responsibly.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
It is 12:34. I have in front of me a book called Elemental, The New Geography of Climate Change and How We Survive It. I also have in front of me the bloke what wrote it, former diplomat Arthur Snell, who now presents a rather splendid podcast called Behind the Lines. This is what Eleanor wrote on my screen for me to introduce Arthur with. Are you ready for this? It's not laminated. Former diplomat and author of new book Elemental, The New Geography of Climate Change and How We Survive It. His first book documented how the Iraq War helped fuel sectarian violence, sowed regional chaos, and created the conditions which later fed ISIS. It was entitled How Britain Broke the World and was published in July 2022, 16 months before the publication of James O'Brien's How They Broke Britain. Are you suggesting that I nicked inspiration for my title from my guest? Thank you very much. Yeah, all right. Everyone's a bloody critic. Arthur, welcome.
Thank you, James.
Can we begin? I mean, in many ways, the two books work in conjunction with each other, don't they? But let us begin with the first book in the Middle East and with your thoughts as a former diplomat and as a keen observer of these events on what is happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're seeing now almost the sort of final destination of decades of bad policies in the Middle East. I was personally involved in the war in Iraq as a young diplomat, and so what I saw with my own eyes fed into something that I wrote about. But what we're seeing with Israel and America's war on Iran is something where there's just no plan at all. There are no objectives. They've taken on a huge country, a country of 100 million people nearly, a huge territory. And it's sort of staggering that something this poorly thought through could be happening at this time in human existence, but it is.
And it makes a mockery of what we both do in rather different ways for a living, which is trying to analyse events that, in this case, are pretty much unanalyzable.
Well, I agree. And what's odd is, for example, you know, the Straits of Hormuz, obviously the headlines just now, a few tankers being attacked there. Anyone who's talked about a possible conflict with Iran at any point in the past 20-something years, the first thing you say is, well, they'll block the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, that's the sort of thing that you'd expect someone to put in an A-level politics essay. Mm. You know, you don't have to be top-level sort of CIA analyst to figure that one. And yet it seems to have come as a bit of a surprise to Trump and his people.
Yes. I mean, it genuinely does. Mm. I mean, it brings us really to the nature of of war is changing, and that's one of the central themes of your new book. This is, in a sense, it's albeit that it breaks all the rules of old-fashioned wars by dint of not having any form of plan or political objective, as Colin Powell would have called it, or tell me how this ends, as General David Petraeus would have said. I mean, it is a war that's being fought on traditional lines. Those are not the kind of wars you foresee in the future.
No, and I think, so what I write about in this book, Elemental, is the way that the climate crisis is affecting all aspects of human activity, but even ones where we think it's got nothing to do with climate. So in fact, you could talk about this conflict with Iran. It's not a bad example, because actually, the degree to which there is instability in the Middle East region has been fed over years by a worsening climate. It affects people's access to food, water, and of course to energy. And so people aren't fighting wars perhaps because they've got a very clear political objective. They might be fighting wars because they feel a kind of existential threat to what they regard as their means of existence. And I think particularly if you look at what Israel is doing, I think Israel wants to do to Iran a bit what it might have done to Gaza, just to make it incapable of responding.
Talk to me a bit about desalination plants, because this is something that many people listening to this won't be fully aware of.
Yeah.
But they've come under attack from Israel.
Yeah. So throughout the Gulf region, to get fresh water, you have to pull up seawater and you know, by a chemical process, which takes loads of energy, turn it into fresh water. Now, one of the oddities of the way that people live in the GCC countries, places like, you know, the Emirates and Bahrain and so on, is that water use is incredibly high, much higher than, for example, in this country where, you know, we have quite a lot of water. There have already been attacks by both sides on desalination plants. So Bahrain has had one hit. There's certainly been one hit
by the Iranians.
Yeah. And then I think the Israelis have hit one of the ones in that feeds Tehran. People can't live, literally cannot live in that region of the world without desalination. So we're not talking about, you know, temporary inconvenience. We're talking about depopulation if you cannot secure and sustain access to water.
And these are not local issues. They are events and fundamental changes to how people live on this planet that will reverberate around the entire planet, even though the ripples begin in the Middle East, not least because life itself is becoming increasingly unsustainable in some of these countries as they get hotter, and as the wealth that they derive from fossil fuels will inevitably diminish as the use of fossil fuels diminishes and the finite resources run out. And this is epochal, isn't it?
Yeah.
What you're writing about in Elemental.
Absolutely. And I think what's really interesting, when we talk about the Middle East, we are looking at the end of the hydrocarbon era. You know, we are living to see this epochal moment in human history. And of course, a lot of people don't want you to believe that, not least the governments of the Middle East, because their business model depends on it. And actually, you know, Donald Trump and his administration have also decided to back that particular horse, probably wrongly. So that they'll tell you, oh no, there's always going to be a hydrocarbon economy. Now, this is not about oil running out, just so listeners are very clear. This is about us not needing it, or certainly needing a very small amount of it. And if we need a small amount of it, then, as you say, the economic basis of GCC countries is finished. And in the same time frame, the livability, the bare temperatures, everybody knows you don't go on holiday in Dubai in August, but they'll reach a point where you can't step outside in August. It's just simply not safe for humans. And I think these are the things that are driving quite a lot of Middle Eastern governments to take really radical measures. And MBS, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, he's one of those people. I don't think he's got a solution, but that is driving the kind of fear that motivates him.
Tell us why it was a holiday in the Swiss Alps that prompted this book.
Yeah. So my hobby is climbing mountains, wholesome activity. But just over 20 years ago, I was climbing a big mountain in Switzerland, and I was caught up in an immense rock fall. I'm not talking pebbles, sort of rocks the size of minibuses. And I was very lucky to survive, and it was obviously one of those days that you don't forget. But But what was sitting behind that is the fact that your average alpine mountain is a pile of rubble stuck together by ice. That's all it is. And when the ice starts to melt, these mountains start to collapse. And we're seeing across the world of high mountains, whether the Alps or the Himalayas, you're seeing more and more of these huge avalanches, huge rockfalls. Only last summer, an entire village in Switzerland had to be abandoned because a glacier collapsed and buried the entire village. So that experience that I had, I think like many people, you have a sort of memorable, slightly traumatic experience, and you want to know what sits behind it. You know, did we make a mistake? Were we in the wrong place at the wrong time? Well, you could argue we shouldn't have gone there, but it was a mountain that had, you know, regarded as a fairly safe climbing route for decades. But the shift in the climate happening so rapidly is shifting the ways that we look at these issues, and it certainly changed my perspective.
It's an extraordinary metaphor, isn't it? Because the Earth is shifting beneath your feet.
Yeah.
both literally and metaphorically, yeah. and that's what you chronicle in the book. Yeah. It's not an entirely bleak analysis. There's some grounds for optimism here.
Yeah, and I try not to write a sort of doomsday book, because ultimately I think one of the ways that you turn people off from the climate question is by this sort of idea that humanity is finished. And humanity isn't finished. And, you know, I've got teenage children. I know you've got younger kids as well, James. And if you just say to people of that generation, well, we've screwed it for you guys, terribly sorry, it seems like a pointless conversation. Now, the fact is that we are experiencing epochal change. The ground beneath our feet is shifting, but most of us are still going to be here, and we're going to have to work out how we live in this new planet. And of course, some of these things, you know, there is room for optimism. So one of the things I write quite a lot about is the way that China has embraced renewable energy. Now, there are lots of reasons to fear China and its power and the way it likes to dictate the way that other countries behave. But here we've got one of the world's great industrial powers having decided to embrace electrification, renewable energy, you know, fast rail lines, all the sorts of things that will gradually reduce emissions and shift us away from the kind of damaging hydrocarbon dependence we have at the moment.
They're the paradigm, really, aren't they? Because they still continue to consume fossil fuels at an extraordinary rate, but because of the long-term nature of Chinese government, Chinese philosophy almost, they are conscious of the fact that that ain't sustainable, and they're going to be best placed to live in a world where sustainable energy is God, even as climate change deniers in the West love to point at China as an example of why it's pointless trying to wean ourselves off fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, it's very strange. You know, Donald Trump keeps pushing this lie that there are no wind farms in China. Well, you can go on you know, Google Earth, you can see loads of them. But you're absolutely right. You know, of course, they do use a load of fossil fuels, and over recent decades, you know, China's use of coal in particular has been massive. But actually, the statistics appear to point that actually they've peaked already. So the moment, this is a big moment in world history where the largest CO2 emitter is reducing their emissions gradually. And as you say, they have this long-term outlook, which means that they think in 10, 20, 30-year time cycles. And of course, there is...
And longer.
Yeah, and longer.
Centuries in some cases.
And there is a risk with that, you know, that it goes a bit hand in glove with an autocratic system, but democracies have been capable of planning ahead. You know, we're not very good at it at the moment, but it has happened.
It involves a bit of a collegiate approach from the leaders of otherwise opposing political parties, and having just heard PMQs, I wouldn't hold my breath on that front.
Not this week.
Let me share a couple of compliments that the book has already received. A powerful, passionate and utterly convincing book which brings a diplomat's experience to bear on why climate change is driving conflict and disorder in our world, and what can still be done to reverse these alarming trends. That's Lord Peter Ricketts, and Rory Stewart has opined an extraordinary mastery of geopolitics. That's high praise, isn't it, coming from Rory Stewart, combining years on the ground in the most challenging places, a raw instinct for politics and a deep ethical concern for the world in the face of climate catastrophe. A masterpiece. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I also want to ask you a question back in the here and now, which is the question I've been puzzling over, and I think you share some degree of my obsession with some of the engines of influence that I'm about to ask you about. How or why do you think so many in the right-wing media and political establishment managed to get this war in Iran so hideously wrong?
It's a great question. I think something that we have, particularly in this country, in the UK, is this reflexive sort of transatlanticism. And you see it, I mean, let's take an example with Boris Johnson, who, let's face it, has become increasingly irrelevant, which, seems to be quite a good thing. He tied himself in knots because the only thing that Boris Johnson got right in international affairs was Ukraine. You know, he supported them from day one, perhaps because he felt bad about his previous sort of softness on Russia, but give him due. And yet he's tied himself in knots pretending that somehow Trump is Ukraine's friend. And he can't seem to sort of think through the logical fallacy there. And I think you see the same with Nigel Farage and the same with with Badenoch and the Tories generally, that they don't seem capable of understanding that actually the transatlantic relationship, it may not be over, but it's in deep trouble. And I guess part of the problem there is because it forces them to admit that our allies are 25 miles across a short stretch of water in Europe.
Oh, wow. God, don't you just hate people who bring Brexit into everything?
Sorry.
It's outrageous behaviour. Elemental by Arthur Snell, The New Geography of Climate Change and How We Survive It is out now, available in all good bookshops, presumably mediocre ones as well.
Every type.
All the bookshops. 12:47. Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
A pro-Iranian regime march in London has been banned. The Home Secretary faces MPs on the decision shortly. The first Mandelson files are released today. And what are money worries doing to your mental health?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK, so we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including well man, well woman, well baby and well kid. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
A message from TfL.
I saw him in the local news a few days after. His name's Rakesh. They had to put him into a coma just because I didn't look again at that turning. He had two kids. How did I not see his bike ahead of me? Well, I didn't look again. He didn't make it.
Drivers, take another look, not a life. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
It's 10 to 1. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Henry, you've been very busy. Did you miss PMQs? Did you miss Kemi Badenoch at PMQs?
I didn't see it.
Oh, here you go. Here's an update. No, not that one. That's Nigel Farage, which we'll be coming to
don't
in a moment.
Mention the war.
That's Kemi Badenoch.
Oh, right. Yes.
Okay, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm turning into Nick Abbott, aren't I? Except that he presses his own buttons. I've got Keith to press mine. That's the sound of a ferret, if anyone's just tuning in, wondering what the hell is going on. That's the sound a ferret makes. If we played it backwards, then there'd probably be a message to Satan. Oh, no. If we played it backwards, then that would be an actual reverse ferret. Is that too... Are we going too meta? Anyway, Henry, you're here for...
Yes.
Have we got a jingle, Keith? Riley's Reform Roundup.
My partner walks ferrets on Sunday. So
I've heard about this.
Yeah.
Yes.
They smell.
One of those shows today.
Yeah,
isn't
sorry.
It?
I'm not helping. I'm going to start off, James, differently. We're going to start with a clip.
You also pledged, or some of your candidates did, to cut council tax when trying to win elections at local level, and that's gone up. So how do you trust anything
wrong,
you say?
Wrong. Never once last year in the county campaign, including here in Derbyshire, did I ever say that we
but
cut
some
council
tax. Your candidates did,
no,
they haven't.
No. Our literature.
I'll check what the people in Kent said because they're putting it up.
You can listen if you want to, or we can jack it in now. It's entirely up to you.
I'm listening.
We sent out literature with national messaging, which said end net zero, appropriately. Stop the boats and cut taxes. That was national messaging. On individual county messaging, we said nothing of the kind.
Now, that is was described by one publication as Nigel Farage losing it after he was challenged over council tax promises. That was Beth Rigby from Sky News, to give you the other voice. And she was pressing Mr. Farage during a media stunt in Derbyshire with regards to fuel prices. But I think it's becoming a... I mean, there's a lot of talk about these council tax rises, and it touches on another story, James. We did it sort of earlier on in the week. It's only Wednesday, isn't it? But earlier on, when it was he said cutting council tax was actually not increasing it by the maximum amount, which is
well, let's put that in plain English. When they increase council tax, they are cutting it. Was his claim?
Yes. Yeah, as long as it's not by the full amount.
Yes. So actually, we're cutting it, even if we're increasing it. Have I not seen documents? You have to be a little bit careful on social media of campaign literature with his signature reproduced on it, pledging a reductions in council tax.
Yes, but he says that was a national campaign, but sent during a local election. So he's talking about cutting tax nationally as opposed to council tax, was his argument.
I'm demonstrating why Nick Abbott is right to do all of his own sound effects. Have you found that thing that I asked for a minute ago? Because it was reminding me of a song. Did anyone else get... All right, I'm just asking. I just thought, could play the clip again of him going, no. Have you got that handy?
You also pledged, or some of your candidates did, to cut council tax when trying to win elections at local level, and that's gone up. So how do you trust anything
wrong,
you say?
Wrong. Never once last year in the county campaign, including here in Derbyshire, did I ever say that we
but
cut council...
some of your candidates did,
no,
they haven't.
No. No. Our literature...
I'll check what the people in Kent said, because they're putting it up.
You can listen if you want to, or we can jack it in now. It's entirely up to you.
I'm listening.
We sent out literature with national messaging, which said, end net zero, appropriately. Stop the boats and cut taxes. That was national messaging. On individual county messaging, we said nothing of the kind.
So, just to recap on today's show, this is Kemi Badenoch.
Don't mention the war.
And this is Nigel Farage. No, this is Nigel Farage. Anyway, back to Henry Reilly.
There's a story about cats. Reform politician criticised for speech on children identifying as cats. Let's hear from the lady herself. This is Laura Ann Jones, who's on the Welsh Senedd for Reform UK.
Welsh Labour, cheered on by Plaid, have even entertained the idea and utter madness of children self-identifying as cats, treating it as completely normal. Biological reality shredded, parental rights trampled, kids' minds indoctrinated, all under the guise of inclusion.
This is the allegation that some children were identifying as cats. They were asked for examples, Laura Ann Jones. Yep. Her office did not provide any. A spokesperson, when asked for more details, said they wouldn't share the identities of parents who's raised concerns and said it would be a breach of data protection rules. The Welsh Government has said in a statement, we categorically deny this.
So it's just not true. But she hasn't got any evidence whatsoever of children identifying as cats. Or indeed of Welsh Labour or Plaid Cymru treating it as completely normal.
Yes, they deny it as well.
I feel we've overplayed the sound effects, but we could almost have squeezed another one in there. So that's two stories.
So two, I'd like to talk to you next about toilets in Nottinghamshire. Well,
who would not want to hear more about toilets in Nottinghamshire?
Yeah, that's true. A politician has branded the situation an absolute joke. Some councillors saying they had to walk 10 minutes to use the toilet because of maintenance problems at the ageing council estate. I spoke with one of the councillors. He is a Conservative. He's called Mike Adams.
So, yeah, it's got quite a lot of problems. We've also had an issue where we've had toilets that have been not working on the first floor for a really extended period of time, like between six and eight months, and which eventually led to sewage coming down a wall on an interior wall in one of the offices downstairs as well. So lots and lots of challenges. And the boiler broke for a period during winter, and it was absolutely freezing in our offices. You know, we couldn't get any heat to our radiators at all.
And there were some reports of councillors having to walk 10 minutes to go to the nearest toilet.
Yeah, so we've got another building, which is called Trebridge House, which is just down the road and round the corner. But, yeah, it takes about 10 minutes to walk from your sort of office. So it caused a lot of problems for us.
Now, just to be clear, there was a building that they've had since the 1940s, County Hall. The Conservatives, when they were in power, bought another building. Reform UK said that actually County Hall, because of its historic sort of status, should be kept. But as the Conservatives would argue, they're finding out there's quite a few problems with it, including the toilets and the sewage.
Yes, I mean, it's horrible. And this is, again, one of the councils that Nigel Farage told us we should have a proper look at to work out how good a job they would do of running the country.
This is, Nottinghamshire County Council, very big authority.
That's three. It's only, Wednesday? You've done 12 already this week?
We did eight. Sixteenth is Conor Hall, who was the who was the Reform UK leader in Great Yarmouth. He's now joined Restore.
Not refresh. Regurgitate?
No, so it's Reclaim, which is the Lawrence Fox party.
That's still going.
Reform,
which is Nigel Farage's outfit this week.
And then there's Restore Britain, which is Rupert Lowe's party.
Rupert Lowe, who was elected to Parliament as a member of Nigel Farage's party, but has now veered further to the right.
Yes, to the right. And let me just tell you, Conor Hall has said, Nigel Farage is a career politician. He aims to say the right things for the camera rather than speak his mind.
Oh.
I'm just not willing to risk civilization on that kind of uncertainty. Restore is going to overtake Reform. Come and be on the winning side. And he says, once upon a time, I'd have given my life for Nigel Farage. I believed he was the best hope for millions. Now I will fight against him. And so they've lost their leader in Great Yarmouth.
It's good that these people never sound remotely mad, isn't it? I think that's something for which we can all be grateful. Listen, far be it from me to defend Nigel Farage, but it's outrageous to say that he doesn't speak his mind. For example, he spoke his mind last week and he said that we should be supporting Donald Trump's war in Iran in every way that we could. He also said that. And then he spoke his mind yesterday and he said we absolutely shouldn't be getting involved in any foreign wars at all. So he does speak his mind. He just changes it all the time.
Can I say thanks to Steve, by the way, among others, who've been helpfully sending me tips.
Are you getting tips?
I did get some for Cheltenham as well, which is not the sort of tips I was after.
In the horse racing. Let us know how you get. Well, no, don't.
I don't think Ofcom's
quite strict about that. Do you get any more tips about tips?
No tips about tips, but they're very welcome.
And thanks. I want to say thank you to Errol, who gave me £10 yesterday to put in Keith's I Told You So tin as a way of apologising for voting for Brexit in 2016, something that he has been repenting pretty much ever since he discovered this programme. So thank you, Errol. It was a pleasure to meet you. Errol Gordon, to give him his full name, a lovely bloke who I had the pleasure of meeting last night as we came third in that quiz.
Robbed.
We were actually robbed. Played the Joker at the wrong time. That's it from me for another day. If you missed any of it, you can listen back on Global Player or the LBC app. Podcasts galore, of course, on Global Player, including all of mine. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Sorbitt will be with you at 4. Sheila Fogarty is with you now.
Thank you very much, James. As we speak, I can't confirm it's happening exactly as I speak, but broadly speaking as we speak, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is being asked a question about the banning of the Al-Quds March in London. Is it the right decision? That's the first thing we're going to talk about today. Two, if America did, and it's looking increasingly likely that it did, kill 160 Iranian schoolgirls, should that change how the UK engages with America in the Middle East? Keir Starmer had plenty to say about the second part of my question, not so much about the first. Or, as one MP was suggesting yesterday, is it a tragedy of war like, sadly, so many others? We'll talk about that later in the programme.
on your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Kemi Badenoch has criticised the government for continuing with plans to end a freeze on fuel duty despite the war in Iran. It's due to be lifted in September, but ministers say that will be kept under review. Petrol prices have already started to rise as the cost of a barrel of oil shot up above $100 earlier this week. But during this lunchtime's PMQ, Keir Starmer accused the Conservative leader of changing her position on the conflict.
After 9 days of saying, join the war, join the war, join the war. Yesterday she says, I never said we should join. I haven't said we should go in with the US. I'll tell you what's happened, Mr. Speaker. She and the Reform leader have been spooked because they realise they've jumped into supporting a war without thinking through the consequences.
There are further signs the war is having an impact on mortgage deals, with hundreds pulled from the market in the last 48 hours. It's the largest fall in products since the aftermath of the mini budget. Three cargo ships have been hit in the Strait of Hormuz, causing one of the vessels to burst into flames. It's unclear who is responsible, but Tehran has threatened to fire on ships in the key shipping route. A teenage boy has been arrested after a teenage girl was stabbed at a school near Norwich. Police were called to Thorpe St Andrew's School this morning. LBC's Shivani Sharma has more.
Armed police have been spotted at St Thorpe Andrew's School in Norfolk, which is understood to be on lockdown. Pupils were hiding under tables for some time today after a teenage girl was stabbed. Police say she has minor injuries and a 16-year-old boy has been arrested.
Files relating to the appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the US are due to be released this afternoon. Downing Street has agreed to publish them over concerns about what was known about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. Mandelson denies any wrongdoing. And the Met Office is warning of up to 70-mile-an-hour winds for parts of the UK tomorrow. Northern England, southern eastern Scotland and North Wales could be particularly affected. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 102 points at 10,301. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, breezy with sunny spells in the south, windy further north with blustery showers, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
We're into the final furlong at Cheltenham, the favourite leading the way. Oh my word, he's been pipped at the post! But what's this? Huge roars from the Coral punters, paid as cash winners for finishing second. You beauty! With Coral's pipped at the post, win if your horse finishes second by a neck or less this Cheltenham Festival. Oh, that's rewarding! Coral, we're here for it.
18 plus, online and in-shop. Opt-in online from 9am 8th of March 26. First single bet, min £1, max £10. Selected markets. T's and C's apply. Gambleaware.org.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. There's a lot to keep an eye on in the House of Commons this afternoon. As we speak, the Home Secretary is facing an urgent question. In fact, she may already have faced it, we'll triple check, about the decision to approve a request from the police to ban the Al-Quds Day march in London this coming Sunday. She's facing a question on that in the Commons. We're going to talk about it this hour. We'll hear from the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police as well, Sir Mark Rowley. Also around 2:30, Darren Jones, the Minister Darren Jones, he is going to be making a statement about the initial tranche of files connected to Peter Mandelson, as you were hearing in the news bulletin, perhaps just there, related to his appointment as UK ambassador to Washington. It is only the first tranche of files, and there is, of course, an ongoing investigation into other matters and things he may have shared or allegedly shared with Jeffrey Epstein. That's a separate criminal investigation, separate to what's being announced today. And the government has told us frequently that it limits to a degree what they can release now. But we are going to get those first files released at around 2:30, or an explanation of them from Darren Jones, the minister. Before that, though, let's focus in on whether the government decision to approve a request from the police to ban the Al-Quds Day march in London on Sunday is the right one. The reason they were it was taken, is to prevent serious public disorder. That's the reason given by the Home Secretary. The Metropolitan Police asked for the ban, saying it was concerned about the high number of protesters and counter-protesters, adding that the march organisers were supportive of the Iranian regime. Home Secretary Shabana Mood has already said that she's satisfied that doing so is necessary to prevent serious public disorder. LBC's reporter Fraser Knight spoke to the Metropolitan Police Commissioner this morning. He asked Sir Mark Rowley how concerned and indeed prepared the force are for potential violence that could still happen following the decision to ban the Al-Quds March.
We've taken the exceptional step of asking the Home Secretary to agree to us banning a march. That's what the law provides for. This is an extraordinary and unique moment where protest that has an origin linked to the Iranian state at a time with everything going on in the Middle East, a time when we've got people in custody in the UK who've been posing a threat in the UK, the last of many, many cases of that. The potential for violence of a protest which has got more and more difficult over recent years, the potential for violence that was going to be difficult to police with moving marches was significant, and that's why we went to the Home Secretary. She's agreed to this. A static event can still take place if the organisers decide to do that. We still expect it to be difficult, and public order policing can be messy, and public people can expect to see that. But with the conditions we can put around the protest and the counter-protest that will be static, we're more optimistic about being able to control it to a reasonable degree. But I wouldn't pretend it's going to be straightforward, and the public should expect to see probably some messiness and potentially some violence. But this gives us a better opportunity to control that to best effect.
Well, I wonder whether you think this is the right decision or not. On balance, I think it is the right decision. And you'll know that I didn't particularly support the banning of, or the, you know, calls to ban, it wasn't banned, calls to ban the so-called vigil for the Ayatollah who was killed by the Americans and the Israelis, those airstrikes in the initial days of the war. Because I felt, you know, those people are showing us who they are when they do that. You know, it's important that we know who supports the Iranian regime, because we shouldn't be fooled or ignore what it is they are supporting. I mean, it reminds me of my conversation with a caller, Jonathan, yesterday about the rights of women in Afghanistan and Iran. They'll show you who they are. I mean, that's easy for me to say. I'm not in there policing these things. I think this is different because of where we are in this war, and because of precisely the organisations that organise this march and support this march. What they support is beyond the pale. Simple as that, isn't it? Or maybe you, like Jonathan, who called yesterday, disagree and think that it is acceptable to have a march on the streets of London supporting a country, not a country, a regime in that country, supporting a regime that has been bombing European and other interests this past week. They too have been bombed. I'm not ignoring that either. But when you think of what they're